Hello, and welcome to the Mr. Custody Coach teleconference. Tonight on parental alienation, I'm Michael Ambrose here with my partner Lexi from MrCustodyCoach.com.
Hi, everyone.
We are glad to have you here so we can discuss the impact of parental alienation and how we can turn the tide in our own families to protect our children. We have had a lot of questions submitted, and we will be answering those throughout the call as well as at the end. If you are listening live and have a question, please email us at coach@MrCustodyCoach.com, and we'll be sure to get to your question as well. If you're not yet a member of MrCustodyCoach.com, remember that these calls are part of our membership, so if you need more help dealing with your custody situation, you can head on over to the website and join today to get access to all of our resources. Lexi, why don't you introduce Janie Beach?
Hi, everyone. Well, our guest for today for this conference is Janie Beach, and if you are a member and you're on our forums, you will actually know her as the divorce coach. I think she's been instrumental in helping our members and helping even become members from other areas, and so we're really, really happy that she's here. She is a divorce coach in Texas, and she's a credentialed mediator and certified co-parenting coordinator with advanced training in co-parenting and high-conflict divorce, which obviously a lot of our clients deal with, so she's fabulous. She's completed 19 collaborations and has only had two couples drop out, which is pretty good. Janie also coaches high-conflict clients who have minor children, which will be very helpful throughout this teleconference. So, Janie, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks, Michael and Lexi, for having me on here. I'm always excited to be able to share with people who are dealing with difficulties, especially when they've got kiddos involved in divorce. I'm excited about being able to help folks understand a little bit more about parental alienation tonight. Just so you understand, my biggest passion, number one, and why I do what I do, is to protect children from the ravages of divorce. I like to try to help parents see divorce from the child's point of view, and that usually strengthens them and their ability to behave a little bit better and keep their kiddos in mind. So thank you for letting me be here with you guys tonight.
And for everyone just joining us, this conference is probably going to go at least 2 hours, so if you can't stay the whole time, you can listen to the recording. That should be up tomorrow morning, and I will try to send everyone an email when that is up. So please, if you need to bail, go ahead. You're not going to offend us. You know, you'll be able to listen to it when you can and as many times as you can. So if you hear something you're not quite sure or you want to listen to it again, it will be available. And please send us any emails afterwards, too. And especially if we don't get to your question at the end, just let us know, and we'll definitely answer it personally. So, Michael, let's get started.
Okay. I guess we'll start at the very beginning, like most good teleconferences do. And our conference tonight, again, is on parental alienation. So why don't we go ahead and define that. Parental alienation are acts which are intended to sabotage the relationship between a child and the targeted parent. The intent is to turn the child against that parent. Actions may include trash talking the target, making disparaging verbal remarks or nonverbal body language of contempt or disgust, either directly to the children or, you know, maybe having a discussion with others, but the children are nearby. Sabotaging parenting time or access, custodial interference certainly meets that criteria. Denying parenting time, calling the target parent by their first name, which undermines their authority as a parent. Instead of mom or dad or mother or father, they call them by the first name. Or explicitly or implicitly punishing the child whenever he or she expresses anything positive towards the targeted parent. Now, different is the term parental alienation syndrome. And while there's a lot of current debate and discussion on whether or not this actually falls into the category of a mental illness for children, we'll just go ahead and explain the definition of what parental alienation syndrome is. And when the alienation campaign against the targeted parent results in the child deciding that he or she no longer wants to have a relationship with that parent, we're talking about parental alienation syndrome. The syndrome is marked by the child expressing hatred and contempt for the targeted parent, refusing to interact with them, and oftentimes offering flimsy or meaningless reasons for wanting to cut off contact completely with that parent. And more often than not, those reasons have no basis in reality.
Yeah, and so a lot of times when you're really going to want to think about the differences between parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome, is really when you're going to court and trying to bring out these behaviors if you're the target parent. I know we've met with a lot of attorneys who tell their clients don't even mention parental alienation because it's such a title that judges don't want to hear. They think that it has more to do with mental health, and so they only want to hear that from a, you know, quote, professional. And if you're a parent, they don't want to hear that word. They want to hear things, you know, the types of behaviors that are going on, how that is affecting the child. So you want to keep those two things in mind. While you know that alienation is going on, you're going to have to up it in that the court will listen to without thinking you're trying to pull in this word that has some bigger meaning, and because you're not a professional, you don't really know what you're talking about. Amy, I'm sure you've dealt with that before.
Oh, absolutely. And you hit it right on the head. The court does not want to consider it in terms of a diagnosis or a mental health issue because you're obviously not considered an expert in that area. You want to be very careful when you're in court that you don't overstep that boundary or you will lose credibility. And unfortunately, credibility is gold in family court. You want to have as much of it as possible.
Right. So let's start talking about the signs of parental alienation. And these are things that you have probably seen since you're on this call, unfortunately. But they may be some things that you might see in the future and just be aware so that you can address them as they come up. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with the first one?
Well, I guess we would start, you know, they'll speak poorly about the parent, often with foul language or inaccurate descriptions of the other parent. So with regard to that, is that so much the kids as it is the parents?
Well, the child starts parroting the parent. So they're
exactly
saying those things that you know it's coming from the other parent. They're saying, you know, you're mean, scary, they're scared of you,
mm-hmm.
something. And you know that that's not really what they think. You know that the other parent's saying that, and now they're, you know, parroting it back to them.
And essentially what they do is they offer weak or completely unsupportable reasons for their anger towards that parent. And we see this on the phone a lot. The child will be talking to the parent that is promoting the alienation and expresses fear of the target's home. So seconds before the call, they were happily playing or doing some activity with the family. And then after the call, they won't be able to give a reason why they said they were scared at all. I recall seeing that in my own situation many years ago where, you know, we'd be sitting having a family activity. It was time to call their mother, and their behavior would literally change as if someone had thrown a switch while they were on the phone, and then they would revert right back to their playful, happy attitude that was in place before the phone call.
Yeah, and as a parent, especially in that situation, you don't know why their behavior changed so unexpectedly, and you're trying to figure out, did I do something? Did something happen right before that call?
Yeah, it's because you're only getting one side of the discussion.
Right.
So you only see this change away from happiness and glee, if you will, back to, you know, being unhappy, frightened, and then back again.
Yeah, and I think that's often what we hear from clients is one of the first signs. They don't understand that something's going on the other end of the phone where the kids are being encouraged to act in that way because it makes the other parent feel good about themselves in some manner, that the child is scared of the other parent, and they kind of want to take it out on the kid because they're seeing the behavior in the child. They're not seeing what the other parent is doing, so you have to step back and realize, oh, this might be a sign that there's some type of alienation going on, and we'll figure out, you know, what we need to do about that later. So the next
one of the things I want to mention regarding that is, if when you see that kind of behavior taking place with that child, in many cases, it's never been explicitly instructed to them by the other parent or anything like that. They don't learn body language moments after they're born. Basically, they've been learning body language. And that other parent doesn't ever have to explicitly say a word, but they will have taught those children implicitly that that's the way they're supposed to behave when they're interacting with them. So if you try to pin the kiddo down, like, why are you doing that? No, they won't be able to give you an answer because they don't have a vocabulary or even explicit understanding of what's going on there. All they know is that somewhere in their behavior system, they understand that that's the way they're supposed to interact with that parent, so they do.
Yeah, and that's why oftentimes when you ask them about it afterwards, they don't know. They don't know why they said they were scared. They don't know what they were scared of. They don't know why they were crying. They just knew that's what they were supposed to do.
It can't be articulated because it's never been articulated with the alienating parent either.
Yeah, exactly. So the next step that we often see is that the child will profess only hatred. It's kind of a black and white issue. They can't see that, you know, a parent can be good and bad. They'll only see the bad side. So, you know, they're saying you're always never positive. You never do anything good for them. And then the other parent becomes all good. They can't do anything bad. And, you know, obviously that's unnatural to a normal person. You can love someone and be mad at them at the same time, but they don't see that. They only see the black and white.
Next would be supporting and feeling protective towards the alienating parent. Much in the same way as Lexi just described on the previous point, the alienating parent becomes the all-good parent versus the all-bad parent, which would be the targeted parent. And examples of that would be when if something arises, or a lot of times the targeted parent will feel compelled to defend themselves as they start to interact with the child about why they're responding so negatively to them. They may say, well, didn't we do a trip to the zoo last week or something of that nature? And then the child is so affected and so in a hurry to defend the alienating parent that essentially what happens is they start one-upping. So whatever defense mechanism that you deploy under that scenario becomes a contest of who does, you know, the alienating parent always does one better for the child.
We see that a lot. And the next thing, they don't show any empathy or guilt when they've hurt the targeted parent's feelings. So, you know, they'll tell you, yeah, I am scared. They won't be able to tell you why. They'll tell you they're mad at you. They won't be able to tell you why. But they definitely don't care that they're hurting your feelings.
They become almost robotic in their mannerisms and the way they speak and the way they act towards you. It can be quite unnerving. The child also has absurd or unrealistic complaints or accusations against the targeted parent. In other words, the child's looking for any negative to grasp onto and subsequently elevates each negative to a level of abuse. And this often mirrors exactly how the alienating parent sees things. And examples that we can give of that is, if the child doesn't like something at dinner time, they're not real fond of vegetables, let's say, as a for instance. Mom or dad at the alienating parent, mom or dad, doesn't make them eat vegetables, and they learn to understand either explicitly or implicitly that the fact that the targeted parent is giving them vegetables and expecting them to eat them somehow rises to a level of abuse. As ridiculous as that may sound, a lot of the people with whom we interact experience just such things, whether it's mealtime, a bedtime that's not as free and flexible as they have at the alienating parent's house. Any of these little things that are differences between one household or the other, the alienating parent makes it a contest. They give a child freedoms that are not in line with their age, for instance, and when the targeted parent doesn't engage in the same behaviors, whatever it is that the child is not getting then becomes somehow abusive in their view.
And then next, the child takes all of these emotions, they assign them to themselves. They own the emotion. They can't see that someone else has had influence on how they feel about the targeted parent. So, you know, whether the alienating parent is telling them specific things or just kind of leading them down a path so that they can determine that mom or dad is abusing them or whatever negative feeling they're having, they can't see what's happening. And they believe even if you confront them, you know, well, okay, but I know your mom told you this, they'll flat out deny it. They own what they're feeling, and they're not going to be convinced that someone else has put these thoughts in their head. So they're not going to look at them logically to be able to determine that, oh, maybe I'm thinking wrong. You know, maybe someone led me down the wrong path. They really own the feeling.
And this can be especially painful to the targeted parent. If you don't realize that where this is actually coming from, you'll get sucked into the belief that those really are your child's feelings and those really are your child's original thoughts. You'll get sucked in and actually believe that yourself, and that can be excruciatingly painful as the targeted parent. And so I just want to jump out in here and clear that one up right now. We're going to talk a little bit more later on about how we're going to handle these things. But, oh, man, write this one down. When you're in that position and it hurts like that, please know and understand that that is a symptom of alienation. That's not your kid talking. That's the alienation talking. And maybe that can help alleviate some of the pain that happens when you've got a kiddo who is, you know, shouting at you or swearing at you or claiming that it's all their idea that they never want to see you again and so on and so forth. That hurts, but it's not real.
Yeah, I think that's especially important in the older kids because they really, you know, take offense when you're trying to say, well, wait a minute, you know, that can't possibly be how you feel. You know, when it's a toddler or something, I think they get quicker and you can kind of realize that, well, someone's feeding them that. They're too young to really think that, especially if they're using terms that, you know, a normal small child wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You recognize that, but when it's an older child, who's supposed to be becoming independent and having their feelings and taking control in that area of their life, it's really easy to fall into, holy crap, my kid really does hate me. Taking it personally and trying to get to the root of the issue and solving this problem can be really difficult.
The other trap there, Janie, I think you'll agree, is that for the targeted parent who doesn't actually realize what they may be dealing with, in addition to feeling hurt, there also is a risk, and this is where targeted parents have to be really careful. There is also risk of becoming angry and reacting as the anger reaction, and depending upon the age, maybe there's a punishment involved. You know, somebody gets sent to their room because they spoke poorly of the targeted parent. There's a tendency, if you don't realize that this might be at play, that you're punishing the child unnecessarily for a manifestation of the efforts on the part of the alienating parent.
Right. You're holding them accountable for something that they should not be held accountable for. And it's a normal reaction. That's the main reason why I want to bring that out here, and I know we'll talk about it later as well. It is normal to feel incredible pain and to react strongly when you've got a kiddo coming and spotting these things. So I just want to make sure that, you know, we establish for our listeners that if you're hearing your kiddo saying that, do not take that at face value. That is not your kid talking. That is the alienation talking. And I think that can help blunt a little bit of that pain and maybe help to think before you have a knee-jerk reaction that you regret later on.
Which brings us to the next point, which is the child's reflexive support of the alienating parent. In any situation that the alienating parent can do no wrong, and any attempt or perceived attempt to refute or deny this evidence that the target parent is victimizing the alienating parent, which is almost, I don't know, how would you term that, like a double reverse.
The alienating parent especially tries this in court. I'm not alienating my child against him. He's alienating the child against me because now they're trying to fix the problem, but they're spinning it all around, and especially in an older child that gets in the middle of that, it can be really, really difficult to sort it all out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and that's why when we get again a little bit later in, we'll see how we can avoid that particular trap as well.
Yeah, definitely. So the next one is kind of a big one, especially in younger children, is the presence of borrowed scenarios. And this is where a parent will bolster the negative image of the target parent by talking about experiences that the child cannot possibly remember, such as, you know, when they were born, even, you know, going back that far. And the child will say, well, you know, you, and I'm trying to use mom and dad examples here, but you know, a mom might say to the child, well, your dad choked me when I was holding you when you were a baby. And then the child comes to you and says, well, I remember when you choked mom when she was holding me. Well, even if it did happen, there's no possible way the child could remember that from when they were a baby. We don't have those types of memories. But the child really believes that they remember it, and it's kind of like, you know, the false rape memories that children, you know, hold cases about that in the 80s and everything.
Like Martin preschool case,
yeah.
Among others.
Yeah, and it still happens. But you know for a fact the child was too young. Even if it did happen, there's no way that they would remember that. So that's used a lot, I think.
Overall anxiety.
Yeah.
The child is very edgy, very emotional, particularly around the targeted parent, where any specific direction, no matter how innocuous it may be, is perceived as a threat or is perceived as a criticism or is perceived as a punishment. So you end up walking on eggshells, to coin a pretty popular phrase in these circles, around the child, because they're just so edgy when they're in the company of the targeted parent that the anxiety is almost palpable.
I see this a lot of times too, and where you see it kind of spike, and if you're a recipient, if you're a targeted parent, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It spikes at exchange time, and during that first little transition period, right after the exchange, when the kiddo first gets with you. And you can see a lot of real anxious behaviors during those times coming out. And that's, again, a sign that there's something amiss going on at the other parent's home.
Definitely. And then the last one that we're going to talk about today kind of ties in with that, and that's actually regressing to earlier childhood development levels. You'll see this a lot in the younger kids. You know, a five-year-old will go back to sucking their thumb. A child who has been potty trained for 2 years goes back to wetting the bed, and you're trying to figure out why. You know, a child might start baby talking again, and they're trying to find that comfort zone that they used to have, you know, when they were a child, and they actually regress back to those behaviors.
Now that you have an idea of some of the signs to look for, again, that's the signs that you're going to see in the children that parental alienation might be at work, and you might already be seeing these in your child. Let's discuss how the alienating parent is encouraging these behaviors and what kind of things we can do to stop it. And to kick that off, we'll switch it over there to Janie.
Well, as Lexi said, there are types of things a parent will do, an alienating parent will do, to try to alienate them from the other parent. And I want to point out here really quickly, when you have an alienating parent, when their actual aim is to sabotage the parent-child relationship between the child and the targeted parent, when you have active alienation where that parent is deliberately and purposefully doing things to try to sabotage the relationship. Now, I'm going to tell you right now what I've seen, and this even happens in collaborative couples who are trying their hardest to get along and get to divorce, as well as high-conflict couples. I've never seen yet, in all of my time as a divorce coach, I've never seen yet a couple that was able to get through the divorce without having an oops at least once and say or do something that would have alienated their child from the other parent. I'm not talking about the parents that have the best of intentions and they haven't oops. You know, if I have a little bit of anger and my anger spills over and I say something about my kid's dad and I didn't mean to, okay, that's not the same as the parent who is intentionally and purposefully trying to sabotage that relationship. So I want to make that distinction as we go into this, because you're going to see these kinds of behaviors, but it's also a matter of intent, okay? So these are the kinds of behaviors you might see when you've got an alienating parent trying to sabotage the relationship with the other parent. And we're going to discuss general aspects, how you might see it in your specific situation, and then we'll discuss some ideas on what to do with each example. So one example for a parent who is alienating might offer the child a choice or otherwise lead the child to believe that it's their choice as to whether or not they want to spend time with the target parent.
Janie, would an example of that be, say, asking the children if they want to go spend scheduled custody time with the other parent as if it were optional?
Yeah, that's exactly the way that usually goes. And they make it sound as though it's up to the kiddo to make that decision. The way you prevent that is especially if you're on the targeted parent side, reinforce with your child that children need time with both of their parents in order to become healthy adults. And you want to put that emphasis, let me just put this framework around all of these preventive measures so you kind of understand it, okay? Number one, the emphasis needs to be on what the child needs. So even as you are engaging with your child, emphasize it in terms of what they need. They need access to both parents. So it's not about you saying, I need my time with you. No, no, no. It's you as a child need access to both parents. So that's one piece of the framework is it's in terms of the child and the child's needs. The other piece of the framework is call upon those authority figures that back you up. So in this particular case, you can let that child know you need time with both parents, and the authority figure here, which is the court, the judge, the court order, has also put into place an order that says you'll spend this time with me because the court knows what you need as well. So that backs you up as the parent, and it kind of just takes the legs out from under the argument of, oh, I want to make this decision. No, 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 no. You don't make that decision. A judge made that decision and made that decision for your benefit. So that's how you kind of flip that around and prevent that giving the kid a choice tactic.
Janie, I think it's also important to add that sometimes by the time you recognize this as a target parent, that's often easier said than done, but it is very important. You can do exactly as you recommend here, particularly with regard to making sure that the children understand that your position is that it's important that you spend time with both parents, because combating parental alienation is it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. So the more more often that you're able to project that, you're the parent projecting that it's important that you spend time with both of us, will eventually sink in over time. And as the children grow and age and mature and start to develop independent and critical thinking, those memories will be firmly burned into their brain that, hey, mom or dad, the target parent, was always encouraging that I need to spend time with both parents, and that's somehow different than what I was getting from the alienating parent.
Right, exactly. And it's that encouraging both parents part that is huge with kiddos. No matter what they say, they really do want to have a relationship with both parents.
Yes.
Here's another one that a lot of alienating parents do. They tell the child details about the marital relationship or the reasons for the divorce. They'll go into some adult topics sometimes and inappropriate material. Usually to paint the targeted parent, of course, as they blame them for the divorce and so forth.
Yeah, we see that a lot with clients and even in our own personal situation. The other parent says, well, you know, he left me, and so, you know, that really hurt me. They're trying to get the child to feel bad for them, even though they're the ones that left. And this is kind of the beginning of the situation where, you know, a lot of the targeted parents want to just kind of take the high road. And they're like, well, you know, that's not really important. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to set them straight and, you know, put myself in the situation where I'm then talking about why the divorce really, you know, happened. But you have to hit that line where if you're not correcting that situation, the kids have nothing to believe except what they've been told.
Yeah, they have no alternative frame of reference.
Yeah, so you have to find a way to discuss things with putting them in the middle of it. So,
go ahead.
I was going to ask you, Janie, what's your suggestion on responding to this scenario?
Oh, okay. So I think number one, of course, is to protect the child from adult content and to let them know that that's what you're doing and then to say it in so many words. I'm not going to share those kinds of details. That's a grown-up matter, and I want to protect you from that. You're a kiddo. And typically, especially younger kiddos, they'll not only respect that, they'll be relieved by it. But when they get a little bit older, then they're going to be a little bit more curious and going to want to know more. But when it gets to that point, again, your first knee-jerk reaction is going to want to be, oh, I have to defend myself against these allegations. Oh, I have to, you know, put my side of the story in. And so what I want you to do as a parent, if you're the targeted parent, just swallow that down. And here's what I tell people to do. Stay in the question phase. Stay in the question. Because a lot of times when kiddos are repeating those kinds of details, oh, I heard dad say da-da-da-da-da about the divorce, or mom says you da-da-da-da-da. A lot of times, that's not their real question. A lot of times, underneath that question is a kiddo-like concern. And kiddo concerns are more along the level of, am I going to be okay? Is someone going to take care of me? You know, if mommy is saying things like, well, your dad just up and left us, you know, well, the thing that kiddo is going to be wondering then is, didn't parents do that? Do parents just go away and vanish? Am I going to be left all alone as a little kid without anybody taking care of me? So you can stay in the question space till you get to the point where the kid can talk about what their real concern is. Because 9 times out of 10, their real concern has nothing to do with the blame for the divorce. Their real concern has to do with, am I as a little kid going to be okay? Am I exposed? Am I going to lose something else? I've already lost my family, my daddy, my home, you know, and the list is long because of divorce. So stay in the question space, because most times that'll get you off the hook of having to do that knee-jerk defense reaction.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the way to go.
But when you can, and, you know, every situation is different, but when you can, listening to your kiddo with your heart and staying in that question space will get you a lot further down the road than to just kind of jump right on in with a defensive position. Protect your child. That, remember, I said, go back to that framework. Protect your child. Here's another one that I see an awful lot, and I counsel a lot of parents on this one, because parents always seem so right on this one, and then when we talk, they realize how wrong they are. And that is when they refuse to acknowledge that the child has property and they want to transport their possessions, their personal effects, and their social things between residences.
How might we see different manifestations of this scene depending upon the age? Like, can you just toss us a couple of examples of how that presents itself?
Well, one of the things that I see, and it's a very subtle alienation tactic, is when you have a little kid who has a personal effect, like a lovey toy or a blanket or some other comfort object, and the alienating parent won't allow that child to take that object with them to the other parent's home. So, of course, what they're doing is they're setting it up to where kiddo is going to be at targeted parent's house, and of course they're going to be distressed and anxious and feeling bad, and that's leverage that the alienating parent will then use to sabotage that access time and, you know, try to convince the kiddo who is distressed, oh, well, come on home here, and, you know, here I am, and a lot of times, you know, it's like, oh, your lovey toy misses you, you know, and they'll actually ascribe anthropomorphic feelings to a toy, you know, that kind of thing. So they're doing it for leverage. As kiddos get older, we see this a lot of times. One of the classics is the clothing wars. When a kiddo wants to take a particular article of clothing from one home to another, and the parents get upset and upset about that. And so part of what needs to happen here is age appropriate. If the child has demonstrated an ability to keep track of their things, then those things should go to the other home if they choose to. But if that's a really bad sticking point for a lot of conflict in general, not just in terms of alienation. So a lot of it depends on the age appropriateness and the child's ability to attach to their things and to keep track of their things.
Yeah, I think we also see this kind of the opposite way, where the child has something that we, the targeted parent, doesn't want them to bring, such as cell phone, huge, huge, huge issue, or
mm-hmm.
something that's expensive that the targeted parent doesn't want to be held responsible for, but the alienating parent kind of has a little scheme up their sleeve, whether, you know, if it's the phone, they want to interrupt their time, so they want to shove that phone and make sure it comes to your house, or it's something they're hoping gets lost or broken so that then they can blame you for it. So I think we see kind of both sides of this situation, and it's really hard to deal with either end of it.
Right, and the thing to remember, too, is that if the kiddo is getting put in the middle in that war, then alienation is happening either way. And so that's a difficult one for people to call out on because, you know, people get attached to their possessions, and everybody's got a really great justification for why their six-year-old child must have a cell phone. Yeah, I'll tell you my opinion on that. But the point is that every parent that does the possessions game believes that they're doing it with good justification. But if that kiddo is feeling caught in the middle with their stuff and they're in the wrong place without their stuff, then that they're the ones paying the price. And for simple things, a lot of times, depending on how much access time the parents have, if we're in true 50-50 shared parenting, then mom and dad, both of you, full set of everything for that kiddo, make it their home. And reduce the number of things that they're going to have to talk back and forth and back and forth. So, you know, have extra toothbrushes on hand. Have extra, you know, size, well-fitting, a spare set of undies, you know, pajamas, all those things. So that kiddo doesn't have to take the obvious stuff back and forth and back and forth. It's a big burden to put on them, no matter what age they are.
Excellent point.
Okay, and so here's another one that I see an awful lot of, and this one is so easy to prevent. It's when you have the alienating parent that resists or refuses to cooperate by not allowing the target parent access to school or medical records, schedules of extracurricular activities, and other ways that the target parent wants to get involved in the child's life.
Yeah, we see a whole lot of this, too, whether it's, you know, forwarding report cards, letting you know when teacher conferences are, where practices are, you know, choir rehearsal. They just don't want to share the information. And you're right, it is so easy to prevent that people just kind of smack themselves on the head when they ask this question and you give them the answer. They're like, why did I not think of that? You go straight to the source. You don't need your F to tell you when soccer practices, you go to the coach. You don't need them to get the report cards. You go to the school. You go and plan your own parent-teacher conferences. You know, there's actually a huge questions among clients in the recent weeks about that. You can get your own conferences. You don't need to rely on your ex, and you certainly don't need to schedule it at the same time so that you're warring over the child at that, you know, point in time. The best is just go to the source. Easiest prevention of any of these things.
Yep, absolutely. Remove the other parent as the gatekeeper. That's all there is to it. And I think part of the reason why it's so hard for people to think of that is because when they've been in a marriage situation for a while and one of the parents has positioned themselves as the gatekeeper, that's a paradigm shift. And post-divorce, it does take a little coaching to say, hey, by the way, that person is not the only gatekeeper of that information. You can go straight to the source. You don't have to go through them. And it is an aha moment. It's a fun one, too.
Yeah, and it is. And I, you know, I have a great relationship with my ex. So, you know, we don't go to the sources. We share information with each other. And most people think, you know, that's what co-parenting is. And everyone wants to start out in that situation in the, you know, perfect divorce. And we can really talk things out and share information. And you're not expecting it when that other person just goes, nope, not doing it, sorry.
Yeah. So they withhold that on purpose. And you're right, Lexi, getting to a co-parenting situation does take some work. When you're in a high-conflict setting and when you have alienation happening, you're not going to get to a co-parenting setting. So, you know, a lot of people kind of taught that as the ideal. It would be great, but not going to happen. So go straight to the source for those items. Here's another one that we get a lot, because there's a lot of blame after divorce, and so not only do we have the alienating parent blaming the target parent for the divorce itself, but then they also make the target parent the object of blame for everything else that goes wrong in their lives as well. And so you have every time that they run into financial problems, or if they're feeling lonely and they don't like the fact that their family was broken up, they don't like the changes in lifestyle, all of those post-divorce adjustments, nobody likes them, but the alienating parent finds it really convenient to blame the target parent for everything that goes wrong.
We see It's starting to become a recurring theme during the course of this teleconference, but yes, amongst all the other items that we've listed here, this we see very, very often.
Especially if you're dealing with someone with a personality disorder. I mean, this is right out of the playbook. They're a victim, and the ex is for absolutely everything.
And the most, it's funny you should mention that, the most prevalent example, and we see both ends of the spectrum on this, is your father hasn't paid me child support, so you can't get something that the child wants, or there's some activity that they want to do. And just to make sure that we hit both sides of the coin, you might hear a father say that they can't do an activity because they give all of their money to their mother or something of that nature. So, and again, this is a systematic thing. And I think one of the things that we have to understand that even if you're not dealing with a high conflict personality, a personality disorder, just the general acrimony that surrounds the initial divorce proceedings in the overwhelming majority of the cases can lead to isolated instances. You mentioned this earlier where you have that oops. And when we're talking about this in the context of somebody who's actually engaging in parental alienation, you're looking at a systematic effort where these things all sort of happen in bunches, and it's almost a part of a daily routine where this brainwashing, this effort at portraying the targeted parent as a constant enemy takes over.
Right. And the prevention on this one, it kind of goes back to that framework I was talking about back at the beginning here, and that is, number one, focus on the child's needs and the child's point of view, and number two, draw on your resources of authority that shows you up. So if they're talking about, for example, you know, mommy said we can't do blah, blah because you haven't paid her the child support or whatever, you know, the response of that comes back to assuring the child, I will always take care of you. You always have somebody to take care of you. I will always be here for you. I have always paid the amount of support that the court ordered me to pay. A judge has determined the right amount of money that needs to go from my home to your mom's home, and I have always paid that amount of money. So, again, you go back to reassure the child that they're not going to be the ones, you know, left with nothing, because that's what they're hearing. The alienating parent is just bringing out, you know, life sucks, and it's all your dad's fault, or life sucks, and it's all your mom's fault. And so your response to that, again, is shore up the child, understand what their need is, understand what their concern is, and then, again, draw on those authoritative resources to back you up. You know, I pay exactly what I've been told is fair. And you don't have to take it any further. You certainly don't have to talk about the money amount. Please don't ever show your child the checks or the check stubs, because that's inappropriate. Just reassure them that they're being taken care of, and reassure them that what you are doing is precisely what has been determined is the best thing to do. Here's another one, and I see this a lot, is when a parent refuses to be flexible with a visitation schedule in order to respond to the child's needs, or the flip side of that is when they overschedule the child with so many activities that the target parent can't possibly have parenting time with the child, or when they do, their parenting time is basically as a taxi driver rushing the kid around from activity to activity.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, the problem comes at the beginning when you don't really know that you're dealing with a high-conflict person, so you go into the divorce situation. Your attorney doesn't really know the situation either, so you come up with an agreement that says things like reasonable visitation.
Reasonable phone contact.
Reasonable phone contact, you know, or absolutely nothing about extracurricular activities. So one parent decides they're going to take advantage of that. So the biggest thing is that if you don't have a great custody agreement, you might be kind of screwed in these situations. If you have a chance to go back and redo your custody agreement, it's a great time to think about all of these things, specify that, you know, activities should only be enrolled, you know, so many times per quarter, and it has to be approved by both parents if it's on, you know, both parents' parenting time. But we see this a lot where one parent will just sign up the kid for four different sports, and if you want to see your child, you better get your butt down to the soccer field because that's where they're going to be. And as far as our prevention, you know what? If you have to go see your kid on the soccer field, you go. Until you can get your agreement changed, you go, because that is your custody time, whether they're, you know, in art class or swimming in the pool or on the soccer field or whatever they've done to try to take your time away. Don't let that happen. You still go to make sure your child knows that you're going to be there for them.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly the right response, too. Yes, until you can get a different order in place, a modification or a clarification, then be there. Be there for your kiddo, and then work it out in terms of clarifying the order or modifying the order so that you can have that structure. And Lexi, you're exactly right. There are some hideous court orders out there that leave all sorts of windows and loopholes open for parents to take advantage of if they have a mind to do that. I'm just absolutely appalled sometimes at the sloppiness of some of the court orders that get written and signed off by judges. And I guess what I'm saying there is, don't assume that just because it got approved and signed by a judge and put it in a court order that that's the last final word on the deal. Because judges and attorneys do let some pretty sloppy stuff go by. So, you know, if it's not working for you, look for a way to rectify it. Meanwhile, spend the time with the kiddo.
Janie, I have a question for you. On this particular issue, especially regarding extracurricular activities, can be particularly hard on a non-custodial parent who has an unbalanced custody order. How does a non-custodial parent, say a parent who has a child every other weekend, balance having home time, having, despite the limited amount of parenting time that they have, having some semblance of normalcy around the household with the limited time that they have when they're struggling with a high-conflict ex who has an expectation that, you know, they're going to be at soccer practice in the morning and the basketball game in the evening on Saturday, and then Sunday morning they have swim team, and then you have to return the kid at dinner time on Sunday. I mean, how does a non-custodial parent balance? When can a non-custodial parent just say no, I guess is the question that I would ask.
I think that non-custodial parent should just say no as soon as they reach that discomfort level and say, no, this is too much. And this isn't working. Now, having said that, I think primarily, again, you want to follow the overall tenor of the kiddo. And I'm not talking about if the kiddo is saying, you know, I hate your guts and I don't want to spend time with you because you never let me go to swim practice. That doesn't fly. But if you're listening to your kiddo and they're talking about, you know, swimming is my life and I love it and I want to go the morning, noon, and night, and oh, by the way, cheerleading is also my life and I love it and I want to go the morning, noon, and night, If that really is, and surely, you know, you spend enough time listening to your kid, you kind of have an idea. If that really is that important to them, then my thought would be, okay, then back them up. Don't leave them dangling. Or if they've made a commitment. If, you know, I signed up to play baseball and my team's counting on me. Okay, back them up. Because what you want to teach them as a parent is you make a commitment, I'm going to have to keep that commitment. But the flip side of that is, if you see this kid and they're just kind of going through the motions and they're flopping in the car and they're going, oh, here we go again, and it's really obvious that their heart's not in it and this really isn't their deal and it was really the other parent's idea, then there's nothing wrong at all with saying, you know what, this isn't how we're going to spend our time together. We're going to do something different together because this is our time and this is my parenting time, and as a parent, I'm going to make this call. And that's one of the things I really want to emphasize here. As a targeted parent, a lot of times what gets called into question, and this is moms and dads when they're the target, either one, a lot of times what gets called into question is their parenting ability. They feel as though their parenting ability is being attacked and questioned and challenged constantly. And especially if you've got the kiddo that's been turned against you and saying, I don't want to spend time with you, and then they're giving stupid reasons. And a targeted parent can suffer from a crisis of confidence, okay? And what I want to tell targeted parents is the court gave you just joint custody or the court gave you access time or whatever because the court believes you are an adequate parent, you are a capable parent. again, look into your heart and make those parenting decisions on your own. Don't feel like you have to always make those decisions based on, oh, my God, I'm a terrible parent and somebody's going to call me out. No. If your gut's telling you that little Johnny is going to way too many practices and little Johnny needs to just have a break, go with your gut. You're the parent. So believe in yourself as a parent and make that call based on your confidence in your parenting ability.
Yeah, I think where a lot of the problem comes in with this is when you as a parent, and especially as a targeted parent, you have scheduled other things that you believe are important for your child, but now you can't go to those and your child can't participate in those things because they've been scheduled for something else by the other parent who obviously had no clue, or maybe did have a clue, honestly, and, you know, wanted to cause problems. I think that's where you get stuck as the targeted parent. You know, am I the bad guy because I have something I want to do with my child that I think is important, and am I going to put that ahead of what the other parent thought was important or says they think is important, and how is that going to look to the judge if they go back in front of the court? You know, are they going to be looked at as I'm denying my child a chance to participate in that event because I wanted them to participate in this event? And we all know judges, again, make stupid decisions, and you really don't know, you know, how they're going to see that. So it's kind of a catch-22.
But it's also a listen to your kiddo with your heart. It's also a, you know, learn and watch for those signs. So those are things that you can do. And it's also one of those situations where you might not get it right on the first try, and that's okay. There may be a day that you just keep little Johnny home from swim practice because you feel like he really needs to do something else instead. And next thing you know, you've got the coach saying, well, now Johnny can't go swim in the swim meet because of it. And you go, ooh, okay. And it happens. But no parent is perfect, and no parent after divorce is perfect. So I think the biggest thing, and the caveat I want to put on here again, is if you emphasize your child and your child's needs, okay, because I've seen it with parents, for example, I've had parents who've said, you know, I only get 4 days a month with my kiddo, and for those 4 days, my kiddo is spending all 96 of those hours with me. Well, okay. But if your kiddo is 13 years old and she wants to go to slumber party on Saturday night and it's your weekend and you're demanding that she stay with you because you didn't get to see her, you know, the other 26 days of the month, then from my point of view, that the energy flow is going the wrong direction, okay, because it's going toward the parent. That's the parent saying, I need my kid here to stroke me emotionally. Well, that's no different than what the alienating parent is doing. That's no good. So, you know, in that particular case, it might be tough for the parent to say, oh, my God, I really wanted to spend more time with you during this time, but I see that this is something that, you know, is important to you or is helpful to you or it's beneficial to you or, you know, it helps in the long term. And that might be I go to the swim practice with Johnny, but I'm probably not going to go to the sleepover with Susie. So, you know, again, case-by-case basis. But follow your heart, listen to your kid, be confident in you and your parenting, make sure the energy flow is on behalf of your child and not on behalf of you, and use the resources to back you up as you make the decision. Let's see, one of the things that we also see, oh, my goodness, and this one's really harsh, but I see it way too often. And that is when we have one parent explicitly asking the child to choose, to make the decision as to which parent they want to be with or live with. I've even seen situations where the kiddo isn't even at an old enough age according to the legal requirements of their state, and the parent is already grooming them up for it. You know, only in a couple of years, and then you can come be with me all the time because you can choose me. And they're kind of like on a campaign, you know, for voting day when the kid finally turns 12 or 14 or whatever the age is in the state, and it's like they're campaigning, you know, vote for me on your 12th birthday, and that's harsh.
You know what? As overt as this may seem, it does happen quite often, and it's especially in the form of telling the children that they can choose where they can live when they get to a certain age. And sometimes there's parents, alienating parents out there that are so bold as to ask the child if they want them, the alienating parent that is, to ask the judge to not have to see the other parent, and then using that as the excuse to file for sole custody. The different places that I've seen this deployed by an alienating parent is mind-boggling. I've seen it used over simple issues like a bedtime. If you stay with me all the time, when the time comes and you get to choose with me, you won't have to go to bed at 8 o'clock. You can stay up till 11 o'clock. To situations like the extracurricular activities. I'll let you sign up for anything if you pick me, and it's just as you said. It's like a political campaign. It really is.
And the sad part is the other parent really does. It has to be a choice. They have to choose you. If they choose the other parent, they really think that they don't love them. So they have to make them choose themselves. They can't lose. They see it in a black and white issue. And unfortunately, the kids sometimes start seeing it that way too, you know, so they kind of, that's household, where do I get more of, you know. Then they get stuck because normally this isn't really possible. They can't just go into the judge and say, well, I want to live, you know, my dad's because I have video games there and, you know, he lets me stay up and have ice cream every night. And the judge is just going to go, you know, so the kid is, they feel bad for both parents because they don't get what they were campaigned for and what they thought was going to happen, and they hurt the targeted parent as well. So they kind of end up being losers on both ends.
They also are prone to it. There are so many negative outcomes from this. And one of the areas where it's, although it's horrendous no matter the circumstances, one of the places where I find it most sad to see this tactic deployed is when it's done as a punishment for the child showing affection towards the targeted parent. So if they're interested in phone calling mom, or they're interested in writing, making a craft for dad, or something of that nature, the alienating parent in some of the most extreme cases will leverage that into the choose which parent, choose me or him. You know, it's either him or it's either me. You're either for me or you're against me. And that's where it's particularly sad. But the other negative outcome is that you end up grooming a manipulative child because they can leverage one parent against the other, and they may actually use that manipulative behavior to get the alienating parent to do things for them, which can be really, really dangerous.
Right, and actually I've seen that backfire on alienating parents in a couple of the cases with clients of mine where the campaign was on, but then what ended up happening was, as you said, a very manipulative, opportunistic child was groomed. And this is where you think about kids that have this real entitled attitude here, that they think that everybody is, it positions the kiddo to believe that they and their physical location are more important than they actually are. And so it almost makes the kid like a star, you know, okay, let's see what you can give me. Okay, well, now let's see if you can outbid that. Okay, now let's see what you can give me to outbid that. And I've seen the ante get escalated up until, you know, one parent runs out of resources, basically. The worst case I ever saw was the car case. And this is a vehicle for a girl who was turning 16, and mom was going to buy her a little beater car, and so then dad was going to buy her a little nicer car, and then mom was going to buy her a new car, brand new, but it was an economy model, and then dad was going to buy her a brand new car, but it was a little sportier, and it kept upping and upping and upping. This girl ended up at the age of 16 with a brand new Porsche. And, you know, maybe in some circles that's passe and not a big deal. But where I live, a 16-year-old with a brand new, you know, $80,000 car is a little bit outlandish. And it all was because the girl, who, by the way, was an extremely angry young lady, that her parents would fight over her like this. And all she really wanted was just her parents to quit competing with each other. But she ended up with a car and a very angry attitude. So it happens in this parable.
I was going to say, let's talk prevention on this one.
Well, and the prevention on this one actually is very basic and it's very straightforward. And that is you put it back on the kiddo again and you make sure that kiddo realizes that they need the love from both parents, they need to be able to love both parents, and they have a right to have both parents in their life. And that's one where, especially as the kiddos get older, they're starting to get a little bit of their autonomy anyway. They're very interested in what their rights are and what they have a right to demand. And it's very easy to come back to a kiddo and say, you don't have a right to demand a car from me, but you do have a right to demand that you get to come spend some time with me. And you do have a right to demand that you're allowed to love me and feel affection towards me. So, and towards your other parents as well. You make it about both parents. Don't just make it about one or the other. Always about both parents. The kiddos can certainly get to the point where they say, I don't want to be in a position where I'll have to choose.
One of the things that I'd like to add to that, too, is when you recognize the manipulative behavior beginning to manifest itself as a result of this alienating tactic, don't be afraid, and it really doesn't matter the age. It goes back to one of the common themes that we'll also discuss here is age appropriateness. Don't be afraid to call out a child for the manipulative behaviors. And it doesn't have to be in an angry tone or anything of that nature. Just acknowledging that, hey, I recognize this is what you're doing, and I recognize this is why you're doing it, and this isn't going to work in this household.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, you can even, if you've had that discussion a couple of times, you can even have an open enough rapport with your kiddo that you can kind of even play it off lightly and say, hey, are you manipulating me? Are you jerking me around? You know, and call them out in a gentle, you know, and lighthearted way, but let them know you're not, you spotted it and you're not letting it happen.
You're paying attention. That's essentially what we're suggesting here.
Yeah, we've actually had clients whose children would say to them, you know, well, I asked Mom for this, but it's not because I'm trying to play her, because they knew what was going on. They knew that Mom was, you know, giving them and buying them and, you know, presents every weekend when she wanted something, and she was literally campaigning by buying the best things, and the kids were like, you know, but that's not why I asked for it, really, you know, it's not. So, you know, they do get it, and if you're keeping those lines of communication open, and a lot of these things, if your kids are asking you questions about some of this stuff, you know, your kids coming to you and saying, well, you know, Dad said you cheated on him and that's why we got divorced. It's because they trust you and they want to hear, not necessarily your side, but they want to hear that you still love them, you're still there for them, and that's how it's going to be. So, you know, you kind of get scared when your kids are asking that and you're thinking, oh, God, they're against me, they're believing all this stuff. But if they're asking you questions, it's really a sign of trust. So you have to kind of move forward from that point rather than thinking it's a negative thing.
Yep, agreed. So let's talk about what happens when the kiddo has natural anger toward the target parent, when the alienating parent then leverages that, actually encourages it.
Yeah, we've seen this with clients as well. You know, a kid will get in trouble at school. They'll come home, they'll be punished, you know, as a normal thing, whether it's grounding or, you know, taking a snack away or something. They get upset about it. You know, no kid wants to get in trouble. I don't think I know any kid that wants to get in trouble. So they complain about it to the alienating parent, and the alienating parent's like, well, they shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have been grounded. That's horrible. You have a right to be angry, and, you know, they really encourage that.
They fan the flames, essentially.
Yeah, they fan it, and it's hard because your kid is allowed to get angry. I mean, I tell my kids all the time, and my kids love me, I think.
they do.
You know, you're allowed to be angry at me, and you can tell me you're angry. You can't tell me you hate me. You can't tell me, you know, anything like that. But you're allowed to be angry, and you're allowed to express that if there's a problem. Doesn't mean I'm going to do what you want me to do, but you're allowed to express that. I know that you still love me. So it's kind of hard to draw that line. So how do you suggest responding to this?
And the main thing there, again, is what you were saying. You acknowledge the child's feelings. Acknowledge them as normal. And remind your child also that, you know, feelings aren't forever. You're feeling angry right now, okay, but, you know, in 5 minutes or 15 minutes, you're going to feel something else, and then you move on. But it is important, and this is a teaching moment, really, for your kiddo. It's a teaching moment because a lot of times an alienated parent, especially if you're dealing with one that has a personality disorder, you might have a situation where they don't really understand their emotions and they don't understand how to manage them or monitor them. So it's up to you to teach your child that. So you're on the right track. Like when you talk with the child and you just let them be angry. That's a real emotion. It's natural and it's normal. I want to address another issue here. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just saying the next one is a big one, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah. This is a big one, and this one's actually a dead giveaway. I don't know how it is in other states, but I will tell you in the state of Texas, you've got a parent trying to change the last name or have a step-parent adopt a child or even call the step-parent mom or dad and try to call the other parent by their first name. Those are huge red flags in the Texas family court system. Texas might be pretty darn backwards in some of their biases, but I will tell you what, on that one, there's nothing to get a judge's dander up faster than finding out that mom or dad was trying to change the kiddo's last name or trying to change who gets called mom or dad and so on and so forth. But this does happen in alienation. It's a pretty classic one, and that is when you have the parent who's wanting to change the kiddo's last name to something else, or that they're wanting the step-parent to adopt that child, or they're trying to pressure the other parent to disseminate their parental laws, so on and so forth. It happens all the time.
Well, you know, and this is one thing I like to point out to the listeners at this point, that you can see from each new example that the escalation of behaviors on the part of the alienating parent are virtually limitless. In particular, this one, there were a couple situations where we've seen it. More often than not, we see this when there's a greater distance between the divorced parents or the split parents, where even if they don't get a legal name change, you'll find it. The alienating parent maybe registered their child or children for school under their maiden name, or doesn't include the parent on emergency contact list or something of that nature. So it doesn't even necessarily have to be through legal channels where they try this. They just sometimes, it's as if a whole new reality has opened up and they just apply a new last name or present them without the father's last name. So, you know, it really is virtually limitless the length that some parents will go to cut the other out of the children's lives.
And preventing this, as you said, is very difficult from a long-distance point of view. Because a lot of times the targeted parent then is not in a position to have contact with the child. And so as a result of that, this is one that can then be very difficult to combat. However, the prevention to this one is, again, communicating with that child and making sure that that child knows and feels and understands that you're always going to be part of their life. And you will always be present in their lives to the extent you possibly can be. And it'll be really hard for, you know, the other step-parent to adopt them or whatever if you're right there and you're always around. So, again, it's reassuring that child, coming back to that basic framework. Reassure that child. Answer to their needs. Let me talk for just a second about some of the things that regarding spying or gathering information or even asking, you know, interrogating the child about the targeted parent. So you'll have the alienating parent who is either setting the kiddo up to spy on the targeted parent or I had one situation, believe it or not, where the alienating parent actually bribed the child to steal computer equipment out of the targeted parent's home so that the alienating parent could plant evidence on it to try to falsely allege criminal activity against the targeted parent.
She actually bribed the children to steal from their father. That was horrendous, and I was just horrified at that particular case. But I just bring that up so that you realize that, you know, that like Michael said just a few moments ago, the levels of escalation would shock you unless you're one that's actually experiencing it, and then you're probably beyond shock. But it's not right to use the child to spy or gather information, and it certainly isn't right to interrogate the child and ask about the target parent's personal life. But the way you prevent this, again, is depending on the child's age, you can talk about privacy and trust, personal information, what's allowable to share with other people and what's not, what's private. And so if the kiddo is old enough to be able to hand off that kind of personal information, then they're probably old enough to have that kind of a conversation about protecting and privacy issues.
And, you know, as a parent, this is usually a frustrating part to go through in alienation tactics because it's like the alienating parent right in your house. Can't have a conversation, you're hiding things, you know, I mean, obviously the computer thing is a bit larger than most things, but they're stealing your files, you know, they're going through your things, they're reading your emails, and you literally have a little spy in your house, and you're on your guard all the time, and, you know, anytime you're on your guard 24/7, it's very stressful. Get to be at a loss of what to do. You literally end up not wanting that child to come to your house, especially, you know, talking from a step-parent point of view. You're like, this is not a normal family thing. I should be able to be in my home, be relaxed, talk about what I need to, you know, even going and doing things. You know, you have a parent who, you know, mad because the, you know, ex and their new spouse gets to go out to dinner, and then they're yelling at kids about that, and it's very unnatural to be in your own home and feel like you're being attacked.
One thing you also have to be careful about in situations like these, and you'll find this a lot of times mostly with the younger kids, is being able to differentiate between what information has been communicated innocently versus they're going back to report. And the other thing that you have to be careful of, and I'd like to actually delve a little bit more into this, is how to be able to couch this depending upon the age for the kids. I mean, with older children, it's easier to be very direct about those issues of trust and privacy and all that stuff. But when they're younger, it takes a little bit more time, a little bit of extra care so that they know the difference. A lot of times when they're the children are under a great deal of stress and pressure, too, because they are literally being interrogated by the alienating parent. So as a defense mechanism, just to get that parent off of their back, so to speak, I liken it to the false confession syndrome you see in during long police interrogations and stuff like that. It really does happen. A person will confess to a crime just to get the police interrogators off their back. And it's no different in a situation such as these. Where it's just they just want the interrogation to stop. So there is some level of reluctance, and they just tell the parent, the alienating parent, what they want to hear, because that gets the interrogation to stop. It gets it over with, and they can get back to some semblance of normalcy much more quickly.
Mm-hmm. So in addition, and like you said, Michael, when you're talking about younger kiddos, and even older kiddos are going to do that. They're going to throw you under the bus just to get the other parent off the back. I think sometimes with older kiddos, they actually start to learn to, you know, throw the alienating parent a bone, so to speak, and maybe that's enough. You know, and they'll throw out some little tidbit hoping that gets them off the hook. But I think the other thing, too, is, and especially with younger kiddos, don't give them any material. Don't have any of the kinds of conversations. Don't do those sorts of things. I've had in situations where
parents to say, you know, on the weekend if the kiddo is with you, don't go out to eat at a restaurant. If the alienating parent is going to come back and get fussy about, you know, that you're squandering your money, because the kid has to bear the brunt of that. You know, don't drink when the kids are with you, because if they even mention, you know, you took a sip of a beer, that alienating parent is going to turn that into that you're a raging alcoholic. And if you are one, please go get help. But the point is that don't give the kids material that they feel like they have to protect, especially when they're little. And that'll help them a little bit. As they get older, you might even want to be very explicit about it, especially if you've had the conversation with them about trust and privacy. You may want to be very explicit about it and say, this is something you can tell your other parent about. You know, when your other parent asks you about your time with me, as I know he or she will, you can tell them about this. And I don't say that in a snide or mean or nasty way, but basically, hey, I'm on your side, and I recognize that you're going to have to deal with some interrogation. Here's some material for you.
One of the things that I like to suggest to people is that to differentiate for the kid, as you're saying, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So, for instance, if a parent is asking about activities that the targeted parent did with the child, by all means, talk about how great your weekend was and the things that you did. But if dad's asking about what mom did with her new husband or her new boyfriend, it really has nothing to do with the activities, the things that the child was involved in. There's the difference. And you explain to him that mom's responsibility or dad's responsibility is to take an active interest in the things that you were doing. They're asking about things that have no involvement of you. That's when you want to, you know, question whether or not that's something that you want to share.
Yeah.
Right.
We also help clients kind of give the kids tools for things that they can respond with that don't answer the question, but give them something to say to kind of get them out of it. Like, oh, you know what? I don't really remember. I was so busy playing with my friend Fred, you know, or, you know, they didn't really do anything this weekend. Something, a line that they can practice saying and kind of have right there at the ready when they're being interrogated that gets them out without saying, you know what, I really don't want to answer this, but I, you know, I don't want to get in trouble for it. So it's an answer that doesn't give an answer but doesn't get them in trouble.
Yep. Well, that's a toughie. Because that's a hard one to try to protect your kiddo for something when you're not the one that's physically there to help protect them. Here's another one that I see this one, and this is kind of related to the extracurricular activity, gambit, and this is another one alienating parents do is they like to arrange different temptations that will interfere. So not only to sign up the kiddo for activities, but, you know, arrange. I've had it where the alienating parent will set up birthday parties and, you know, will have big activities with church, buy the kid a new toy just on the same afternoon as the exchange. Oh, no, that stays here at my house. That's not going with you. Or pets. Pets are huge leverage that alienating parents will get as temptations to hold the kiddo back. So the whole idea there is putting the focus on the alienating parent's home and making the child want to be with the alienating parent and not happy about having to be with the targeted parent because of the temptation that has been arranged for them.
And Janie, I can't think of a single case that I'm aware of with the people with whom we work where this tactic hasn't been used by the alienating parent. I liken it to another form of custodial interference, where, you know, the common experience with custodial interference is flat out refusing to show up at an exchange or turn over the children for a particular parenting time. But when they use this tactic, this arranging temptations that take the focus of the child away from their time with the targeted parent and have them longing to return home, or their focus is what's going on back at the alienating parent's house, it really undermines the parent-child relationship and interferes with the custodial time. It's literally, in my opinion, another form of custodial interference. and you give the child something to long for returning home. It's a real common theme. You touched on the pet issue. The pet's a big one because that's the alienating tactic that keeps on giving to the alienator. I know that I experienced that in my own situation personally, where you get your custodial period going, and a dog has been purchased, or a lizard, or a parakeet, or you know, insert the type of favorite childhood pet that a kid would be interested in. And the rest of that custodial period, that parenting time, is spent they just can't wait for the time to end so that they can get home and see their new pet.
And the alienating parent often takes it further and, you know, specifically has the child ask to come home early, and then you're the bad guy because you say, well, no, you know, this is our time, and we need to have our time, and you'll get to meet
them. So you see a combo tactic here because it's the setup with having the object or the sensation. It's the setup with the kid saying, you don't have to go with the other parent, or you can come home anytime you want. And that all sounds very sweet and innocent, doesn't it? And then you get the triple whammy when the kiddo calls home or calls back to the other parent's house while they're with the target parent. And they call back to the alienating parent's home while the alienating parent calls on the phone. And, oh, Fluffy really misses you. Oh, Fluffy looks so cute and would look even cuter if you were here. Oh, I'm petting Fluffy right now, but Fluffy really wishes you were petting him instead. And they can play that one real hard. And, you know, the kids, they're petty. In the face of that kind of manipulation, they're absolute petty. So what do you do? Well, so the hard part here is not trying to top whatever special thing they're longing for to get their attention back. Don't get in an escalation wall here. Oftentimes, just being a very simple, straightforward, oh, that's great, sounds exciting. And I can't wait to hear about it when you get back to your other parent's house. And then just move on. Move on to normal activity and do exactly what you would have been doing with the child anyway. Let them know that it's a blip on your radar, but that's all it's worth. And it's just not something that is all super all-consuming important right now. If you play it off as a normal event, most times kids will take your leave. For older children, it might be important to have a discussion about how it makes you feel when they come and then can't engage with you because they're so engrossed with what is going on at their other home. That can sometimes help another child put things into perspective, but you've got to be careful there because if that child has already been alienated to the extent that they can't feel empathy for you, then that prevention tactic is not going to work. They really aren't going to be in a position to care. But it might help to at least put it out there so they recognize that there is more empathy and more expectation of exchange of feelings there between you and that child. It might even get them to realize why the other parent is doing things without having to outright say, you know, gee, your other parent is manipulating you and not wanting to spend time with you. Sometimes they can figure that one out on their own. But the main thing there is you're going to want to start getting into a contest to make it bigger and better so that they'll pay attention at your place instead of the other place. Don't fall for that. Do not fall for that. Minimize the impact of theirs rather than elevating the impact by escalating on your end.
And this might take a little bit of time to work through as well, particularly where pets are concerned, because the attachment can be so great between a pet and the child and the pet. And that's why I said that it's the tactic that keeps on giving to the alienating parent, because, you know, it goes beyond just that initial excitement of longing to get home to see the new pet. There's going to be another time where the child has to leave a beloved pet and come to see you again, and the cycle can start over again. So it's not something that accomplished in one weekend or one week. It's going to have to probably be revisited a few times before the schedule takes over and this just becomes a normal part of the routine coming and going.
Right. And that's another piece of the tale I want to help you understand is have empathy for your child. It is hard for kids to have to up and go to a different home on a regular basis. So, you know, and they are leaving stuff behind, and they are leaving a pet or something else that is, you know, an emotional attachment behind. So there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying, Well, I know it's difficult for you to say goodbye to Fluffy for a couple of days or whatever, but you can also express your confidence that they are old enough and strong enough to be able to handle it. Say, okay, I know that's hard, but here we are, and we're going to do these things together, and I know you can wait until, you know, Sunday night or Monday or whenever it is if they go back to the other parent's house. So I know you're strong enough to wait that long before you see Fluffy again, and I know Fluffy can handle it too. And so I think it's important to acknowledge how they're feeling and what they're going through, but also express your confidence that they'll be able to handle it.
Very good.
This is another one, very emotional manipulation. And I want to bop over the head every parent that does this. And those are the ones that that are sad or hurt or put on a big to-do whenever their child exhibits having a good time with the target parent. Because it's like they expect that the kid is going to go be with the targeted parent and just be miserable the whole entire time. And if the kid expresses any kind of positivity about it at all, then the alienating parent gets upset or hurt or angry.
Yeah, this is the one that really makes me feel bad for them, because they really are stuck in a position that actually ends up being a cycle, because the alienating parent actually believes, I mean, in most cases, they really do believe what they spout out. They believe that their child hates the other parent. Okay, so they believe they're trying to protect the child. So what they do is they set them up. You know, they have their reactions when the child says anything positive about the targeted parent. So the child learns that they shouldn't say anything positive about the targeted parent. Well, now the alienating parent hears that the child never says anything positive. So it reinforces the fact that they think they hate the targeted parent. So it's this huge cycle that just keeps going, and you have to figure out a way to stop it, because the targeted or the alienating parent will use that information, you know, whether it's to file sole custody or, you know, convince the child to write nasty letters to you, you know, they're going to use it to their advantage. So how can we prevent this? This is a pretty big one where the child is really stuck in the middle.
Well, and the way you get them out of the middle is to give them the opportunity to express a good time with both parents when they're with you. So their experience with the alienating parent might be what we've just described, but that doesn't mean that needs to be their experience with you as the positive parent. The biggest difference we've seen in children is making sure that they can always tell you what a great time they have with the other parent. So the big thing is here is as you get that child and they come with you, make it a point to ask them about what fun things they did and how enjoyable it was, and focus on those things. And again, just listening with your heart, be careful you don't accidentally get over into where it feels to them like it's just one more police interrogation, or they'll think that you're just like the other parents. But the important thing is to focus on their feelings and help them realize and understand how important it is that they can say positive things about the other parent in real presence. You don't ever abide with the splitting and the all good and the all bad that they experience with the other parent. I'm just going to give a little personal example of that from my own situation. My stepkids have had the opportunities in my home, and of course, you know, being that this is what I teach people to do all day, and I make sure they have this. But I didn't realize how huge it was until my stepdaughter came to me on Valentine's Day, and she made a comment to me about how her mom had always made Valentine's Day so special, because she had put the donuts on a little cake plate and arranged them all pretty and put little homemade cards with handwritten poems on there and the whole bit. And the fact that I was able to sit there and listen to her talk about something that was really special to her with her mom, and her being able to tell me how important that was and what it meant to her, and what I didn't realize was until months later that my stepdaughter made the comment to another person about what a relief it was, that she did not have to walk on eggshells around me. She didn't have to worry that if she said something nice about her mom, that I wasn't going to get all competitive or, you know, feeling like I had to one-up her or cut her down or anything like that. And I hadn't even realized she'd noticed. You know, but to me, it was just, oh, isn't that special? I think that's a wonderful thing, and I'm so glad your mom loves you so much. But for her, that was huge. That was a big thing to have a stepmom that wasn't going to get all wound up in some kind of little contest. So so do make sure that your children realize that when they're around you, quitting doesn't happen, the contest doesn't happen, feeling bad if they've had a good time with their parent doesn't happen. Eventually, those children will learn which parent really wants them to be happy, and they'll know that it's you.
One of the suggestions that I like to make to people, it's the easiest question to ask. It's non-interrogative, if there is such a word, is in order to encourage just what you're saying, the question to ask when it's time for you to have the children for your parenting time is, tell me what was the favorite thing that you did this week or this month or weekend or however it was. Just tell me your favorite thing. And that just gets so open-ended that the child can come up with anything. It might be something related to the parent. It might be something related to school. It might be something related to friends. But it just it engages that positive dialogue so that it's not the negative interrogation that they're used to on the other side. It opens it up for a positive discussion, something that they have to stop, they have to think, and they're going to come up with something that was exciting that they want to share with you. And that just is the positive vibe that's generated right out of the gate is huge. Another suggestion that I want to make, because there is a downside to not engaging in such conversations, particularly where your experiences with the child are concerned, is that if you don't, I like to take the time to remind the children in an unassuming way. You do a review at the end of your custodial period. Maybe you're sitting down, it's the night before, and you're having dinner, and your dinner conversation is discussed much the same way. If you don't talk about the positive things that you've done with the children, they can sometimes be overlooked or forgotten under the weight of the alienation that's going on from the other parent. So in order to avoid having to remind them somewhere down the line, if you've done a special trip or had a special event this week, or maybe you just had a normal, regular weekend, you just open up the dinner discussion with, so tell me, what was your favorite thing to do this week? Uh-huh. And again, it's a positive introduction. It's very open-ended. It gives your child time to think and discuss something in an excited manner.
Yep, exactly. And that's that is an important thing to remember is that when you're reviewing those positive experiences in their life, you are helping to inoculate them against alienation because now they're owning their own experiences, they're owning their own memories, they're owning their own perceptions, and that is one of the best things that you can do to help your kids guard against having the emotional manipulation and the mental manipulation and control to take place with an alienating parent. So they'll own their own experiences. They won't buy into the false memories that the alienating parent is trying to implant in them.
I like to call it heading them off at the pass. If you talk about positive moments that you've experienced together before they go back, under the guise of just having a normal dinner discussion, you effectively undermine the efforts of the alienator.
Yes, you do. That's also a good place where you might be able to make, if you're in the right situation, what we were talking about before, help prepare them for the interrogation that's to come. And make real clear as you're reviewing those positive experiences. You can even, if you've had the preparatory conversation, you can even say in so many words, that would be something you could share with your mom if she asked. And, you know, give them explicit permission. And I'll talk about another one that happens because this is another one of those little subtle ones where kiddos get manipulated. And that is when the alienating parent physically or psychologically rescues the child, even when there's no threat to their safety. And sometimes there's a setup, you know, when the kiddo is leaving to go with the other parent, with the targeted parent, and you hear the, you know, are you going to be okay? I'll be checking on you. I'll check in on you. You know, if you get the least bit scared, you can always call me. I'll come get you. And they set the kid up to feel frightened and to feel as though their safety is in question And I've even seen it where the alienating parent will continue in that scene as they call incessantly during the child's time with the targeted parent and continue to sort of set the child up to have a belief that they're not safe.
Yeah, we've seen that one on the phone especially. We've actually heard recordings of the phone conversation afterwards so you can hear what the other parent is saying, and you really realize, you know, parents start off a conversation right away. Are you okay? You sound sad. Child will answer, no, I'm fine. And they just keep going. Oh, are you sure? Because you really sound like you're going to cry. And eventually the child understands, oh, yeah, well, I'm supposed to cry, so now I'm going to cry. And then the alienating parent gets to swoop in and say, oh, well, it's okay, you'll be home soon. Why don't you even ask that if you can come home now because you're so scared? You know, they become the protector and they get to save the child even though the child really wasn't scared of anything. And being able to hear that conversation the other end was something get to hear, so overhear something like that, be honest, ask your child, you know, well, I heard I can help you, you know, what are you scared of, let me know, you know, open that conversation. Tell you what they are scared of, or realize, oh, well,
that's a really great point, Lexi, and I want to throw out one caveat there. Make sure that if there's any phone conversations being recorded that you're following, you understand what the laws are in your state regarding wiretapping, and that you're permitted to record conversations and that you're in keeping with the law, because it could have serious consequences. With that in mind, I would like to say when you hear it, when you actually hear the other side of a phone conversation where overt alienation is taking place, it's really hard to listen to, and the level of frustration that you might feel initially can be pretty significant. When you recognize the systematic effort that the alienating parent is deploying to literally shape the reaction of the child, you understand the depths of, it's hard to put into words because I went through it myself. And when you hear that, it can be very unnerving because you hear the prompts, you hear the verbal cues that are being given to the child, and seeing how the child reacts to those verbal cues. And earlier in our conversation tonight, we talked about how they can flip that switch and turn on that emotion. And this, again, can develop manipulative behaviors on the part of the child. But they'll go from being happy and gleeful and enjoying their time in one household to having a phone conversation where they've turned that switch, changed their emotions to satisfy the clear needs of the parent, and then when that phone conversation ends, they go right back to the way they were before the phone conversation started.
Yeah, we've actually heard a really extreme example of this where the child was not only talking to the alienating parent, but that parent had family members there, and so the child was talking to, in this case it was a mother, and then he would talk to grandmother, and then he was talking to his aunt. And while he was talking to his mother, he was upset, he was crying, he was scared, he was angry. And then when he was talking to the grandmother and the aunt, he was talking about how much fun he had fishing and all the things that he did at the park and, you know, all of these positive things. And you could, there's no explanation other than he knew what he was supposed to say to his mother, who was the alienating parent. And it's amazing that they have that much control and can really make a child do that,
yeah,
without saying, you need to cry right now. I mean,
well, and I want to address a couple of things there when we talk prevention here. And number one is, as Lexi also mentioned, it can be extremely disconcerting for a parent
to witness their child being so blatantly manipulated and watch that happen. That's gut-wrenching. And so my number one thing would be that as a parent, as a targeted parent, if you're seeing your child going through that, try your hardest there. Just take big, deep breaths, you know, stretch your arms out, whatever you need to do, count to 10, and get your own emotions under control before you address it, because it can be emotional and it can be very difficult to witness your child going through that. So that's my number one thing as a targeted parent. If you're watching your kid have that switch turned on and off by that manipulative parent, and it's just so gut-wrenching to witness, get your own emotions under control. The other thing I want to talk about very quickly is a lot of times when you're the targeted parent and you have this question in your mind, when should I speak up and defend myself and when should I not? This is one of those times when you should absolutely speak up. And I'm not necessarily that you're defending yourself in this particular case, but what I'm saying is this is not one that you should let just go by or find some other way to deal with. This one you deal with directly. If you overhear your child talking to the other parent and not being emotionally honest, if they're pretending to be scared if they're not, or pretending to be angry if they're not, or upset if they're not, then you need to address that with them afterwards in a non-judgmental tone. Don't rake them over the coals, but let them know that you are there to help them address whatever it is, whatever emotion that they were expressing. But if they can't articulate where that came from, it is important that you have that conversation with them about expressing their emotions honestly and not pretending to be something or feeling something they don't feel, or help them understand why it's important for them to not say they're feeling something, or, you know, claim that they're feeling something if they aren't. So address that one right away. Get your own emotions under control first, and then do confront your child on this one. Help them learn, because emotional honesty is important, and it is an important aspect of emotional maturity. So they do need to learn that, and as a parent, it is your obligation to teach them that. We hear another one also. It's related to that when kiddos are on the phone and especially when they're at the alienating parent's home and they're talking to you and the alienating parent interrupts or interferes with the child's phone conversation with you or gets on the extension and jumps in. So this is another tactic that alienators like to use.
Yeah, I don't think I know any alienator that doesn't use this one. The phone issue is just huge. A lot of it stems from, again, the really, really bad court orders. My voice is cracking from talking so much. A court order that says, you know, reasonable phone calls. Well, what one parent says reasonable and what another parent says is reasonable are two completely different things. And then what the judge thinks is reasonable is another different thing. They're just not going to work. So then you have, you know, the parents who try to set, you know, a specific time. There's just so many issues that come up with the phone thing. But you really don't have control. If they answer the phone and they pick it up and they want to sit there and scream at you for 15 minutes, you know, you're going to have to sit there and listen to it or hang up and give up that right to talk to your child. It's going to happen, and you should be prepared for it and know what you can do, and hand that one back over to you, Jeannie.
Well, to the example that you just gave, and then that is where the alienating parent actually jumps in and overtakes the phone call and wants to engage with the targeted parent, you know, either screaming or making accusations or whatever. What the targeted parent needs to do, first of all, right initially, they need to just repeat in a very calm voice over and over, please let me speak to you and name your child's name by name. So if your child's name is Joey, it needs to be, please let me speak to Joey. Please let me speak to Joey. Please let me speak to Joey. If that doesn't get some kind of shift in the tone at some point within about 5 to 10 seconds, then you need to very calmly say, I will let Joey know I called.
I'll call back another time, and hang up. Don't continue to subject yourself to verbal abuse or that kind of attack or so on, and then you continue to try to call. So that's one thing that you must do. If you call on the alienating parent who's interfering with your ability to even get on the phone with the child, you need to repeat your request, repeat it several times, repeat it calmly. Don't get caught up and escalate into their emotion. Don't even begin to address the content of whatever it is they're yelling at you about. So if they're saying, you know, where's my child support check, or, you know, the plumbing is broken and it's all your fault, you jerk, why did you leave us? You know, any of those things, the content doesn't matter, so don't address it. Just repeat over and over again. Please let me speak with Zoe. Please let me speak with Zoe. And then after a certain period of time, 5 to 10 seconds, I will call back at another time when Zoe is available. Hang up. Now, there are a couple of things that you want to do when phone access is interfered like that. Number one, always document it, and we'll talk about documentation here in a moment. Number two, always let Joey know, okay, because we never know what Joey is hearing at his end of the world when he's with the alienating parent. But I guarantee that a lot of what he's hearing is your other parent doesn't love you, your other parent doesn't call for you, your other parent has forgotten all about you, especially if you've moved on in a new relationship. Oh, then you love that one. Your other parent has a new boyfriend and doesn't care about you. Your other parent has a new girlfriend and now they won't have time for you. And they're going to use all of those to try to make that child realize you don't want to be part of their lives anymore. So you've got to combat that directly with the child. When you see them, the words that need to come out of your mouth, and not mean or accusing, like, why didn't you call me back? Because, again, that puts the energy flow in the wrong direction. But to say to your child, I was thinking about you this week. I called you on Tuesday. I'm sorry I missed you. I wish I could have said hello to you. I was thinking about you on Thursday. I called a couple of times Thursday night. You weren't available. So, you know, but let your child know. I am trying to get a hold of you. I did try to call. And then you can also put the onus back on them. You know, maybe next week you can try to remember to call me. Or you can put it down to a specific time with the child. Next week I'm going to be calling on Tuesday again. Is there a good time that you can watch for my call and kind of give the child some way to engage in it and be involved in it as well? That's basically it if you're having a hard time actually getting through with the child. The other one that I see is when the alienating parent gets on the extension. So while the targeted parent and the child are actually trying to carry on a conversation, and you have the alienating parent that is either silent on the extension and just basically taking notes and listening in on everything, so the parent and the child are both walking on eggshells because they know this, because they're being listened to, or even worse, when the alienating parent cuts in with snide comments and snide remarks and basically disrupts the phone call. When that happens, it's up to the targeted parent, first of all, to protect the child. So just say to the alien parent, please give us privacy on this call. Please hang up the extension. And again, make your request quietly, without emotion. Repeat it a couple of times. And if you still can't, they refuse to hang up, then again, you say to little Joey, okay, Joey, this isn't going to work for us right now, so let's plan to talk again on and set a specific date and time, and so that Joey knows when he can look forward to your call. And then when you set that time, you make sure you make that call. Even if the alienating parent, you know, make sure that Joey isn't home, doesn't answer the phone, rips it out of the wall, whatever, but you make sure that you do what you said you would do so Joey knows that he can trust you.
Absolutely.
Another one that we see a lot of times is we see the attacks, the onslaught of attacks against the targeted parent. And I'm talking about explicit attacks now, but a lot of times you'll even have the well-placed eye roll, for example, you know, talking or the snide comment of, you know, things like, well, of course your mother doesn't go to church anymore. How could she after what she's done? Or making comments about, you know, his new girlfriend, or, you know,
he sure is living pretty high and mighty on all of his salary. It sure would be nice if he'd throw a little bit of that money this way, but obviously he doesn't love you well enough to give you any debt, all that extra dough he's got. So when you hear a lot of those kinds of snide comments about things that have to do with the way they live, their relationships, their lifestyle, a lot of money issues, a lot of anger and bitterness, a lot of attacks on their morals and their ethics and their character. So this one actually happens quite a bit with alienating parents. Especially, again, you'll see this early on in divorce, even when that's an oops. But the intent, if the intent is that constant attacking.
I was going to say that's parental alienation 101. And sometimes I find that that can be cyclical in that, like you said, you usually see that, a spike in that early on in the divorce, and that might go away depending upon the nature, you know, the personality that you're dealing with. And that spike will actually come back up again, particularly if there's a new romantic partner that enters the scene. And one of the things that you can do for prevention is one I like to do, is reminding the children that it's just not nice to talk badly about someone. It's the golden rule, so to speak. Often I think they feel bad about it, and that's why they tell you. And I've even seen kids apologize for the way the other parent and their family members talk. So letting them know that they can stick up for you, and if they feel pressure to join, that it's okay to decline nicely. Give them the tools to move past the negative talk and just reinforce their need to be respectful in their delivery. Again, presuming this is all about age appropriateness again, presuming that they're old enough to understand what they're doing. They might not be inclined to do that if they're typically going to suffer some significant level of consequence, but at least give them the power to decline in a respectful manner to engage in that type of behavior, even if it's encouraged or is going on around them.
Right. The only thing you want to be careful of is that when you remind your child that it is important to be respectful, and what you're doing here is you're teaching them manners. You don't want to do is either strongly imply or even explicitly state, you know, well, someone has to teach you manners because obviously you aren't learning any at that other house. Well, okay, guess what? You just stepped over the alienation line yourself. Go ahead, Lexi.
I was just saying, we all have those once in a while. It can be frustrating when you're being personally attacked, you know.
Oh, heavens, yes. It's hard, and it's hard to stay vigilant against that all the time because you are when the onslaught is just relentless like that. It takes a lot of energy. It really does. I've seen this an awful lot, and I wish it wasn't so, when the alienating parent just plain rewrites history, such as suggesting to the child that the target parent never cared for him or her, even as an infant. This child has absolutely no memory of prior events, and so they can't determine whether the alienating parent is telling the truth or not.
We see this a lot with the allegations that the targeted parent abused the child or the other parent when they were little, and that can even go so far as to create, again, something we mentioned earlier in the program, go so far as to even create false memories for the child where it's clear that the child might tell you a story that they've heard from the alienating parent, and it occurred at a time when they were of an age where that memory would not form in their own mind. But they have this level of detail that not only would be inappropriate in terms of their ability to recollect the event, you know, maybe they were 1, 2 years old, but they have a certain level of detail that could only have come from an older person.
And repeating the story too, we actually saw not one of our clients, but a story I saw on the news recently about foster parent who was accused of abusing a child, and the birth parents got custody back and coached the child basically for the next, you know, 3 or 4 years until it went to trial, what this child saw when he was like 2 years old, And when he got to court, this child could remember every single thing about what this man supposedly did to the baby that he had care of and was being accused of being abused, but yet couldn't remember if the family had a dog when he lived there. Now, a child is going to remember if a family had a dog before he's going to remember what color the pillowcase was that, you know, his foster dad smothered the baby with. But he could remember every single detail of, you know, the story that he told when he was 2 years old, because his mother had been going over that story for, you know, 4 years with him. So it's hard because you sit there incredulously and realize that's what's happening. But how do you communicate that to your child?
Well, and you don't, because that's, especially when it's a suggested memory or a false memory, what we know as false memories that have been suggested to the child, those suggestions can actually be rooted in very strongly. And many children, that even when it is known that the memory implanted in them was false, will still hotly defend it and claim that it was real to them. So the main thing here, again, communication. You should always be talking to your child about activities that you did when they were young. If you've got pictures, photos, even better. All of your family traditions, the things that you go back to that are steady, favorite places you've gone to, favorite stories that you read to them. All of those elements. So that your kiddos, not only do they understand that you've been involved in their lives all along, but those are anchors, and those are very important anchors for those kids. Those are emotional anchors. Even if they don't personally remember all those details, that's a solid and a stable place for them. If there are false allegations, take the high road and ignore it, but make sure that you do go back and make sure that the child understands the story is false. You don't have to delve into a lot of the details. A very simple statement of, no, that isn't true, is usually sufficient. You don't have to say, oh, your other parents are just that liar, and I can't believe they say such hot, awful things. And you know, no. Don't even go there. But simply, no, that isn't true. And then go on with the anchor, those stable things that you have established with your child that you do know are real, and your child knows are real. That's what helps build up and prevent the ability of these false issues to be implanted in them.
Excellent. One of the things that I wanted to do at this point in time is we've gotten into some great discussions here regarding the signs of parental alienation in the children. We've talked about some of the tactics that the alienator are going to deploy and some of the prevention techniques. And I want to shift to a more direct way of how to respond to parental alienation in general situations. And also talk about the age appropriateness of the approach with you, Jamie. So, ways to fight and even reverse parental alienation on the home front. One of the most important things that I point out to people, we've talked about what's the difference between becoming an alienator and having the occasional oops. But the most important thing is to not become an alienator yourself. And there are ways to talk to children that are age appropriate. We've discussed several of them here already. And there's also ways to assist them in discovering the truth about any given situation without overtly denigrating the alienating parent. It is difficult, but it's not impossible. As with anything related to a high-conflict divorce, a high-conflict custody situation, and especially when there's parental alienation involved, you're essentially having your character assassinated to the children that you love and care for so much. It's difficult. It's not impossible. It's just a matter of being age appropriate about it. Lexi?
So the first one is, no matter what is going on, remain involved in your children's lives in whatever capacity possible. You know, it doesn't matter how much time you spend given by the court, or if your, you know, custody arrangement isn't even agreed upon yet and you're kind of in that, you know, no man's land. Whatever you can do to remain involved. Phone conversations, Skype, I mean, you know, web chat on MSN Messenger, sending letters, sending emails, anything you can.
essentially, you know, make the opinion evaporate by showing that you are not about who you've been portrayed to be. Essentially, you're a normal, loving parent who cares deeply about his or her children, nothing more, nothing less. And we understand that there's a certain level of frustration associated with that. It really can be harder on a non-custodial parent with very limited time with the children. And I know, Janie, that this is a point that's near and dear to your heart about not giving up the efforts to communicate. If you want to expand on that, I would be grateful.
Right. And primarily, again, go back to that framework. Look at what your child needs. Because your child needs to know that you were still there, that you were still trying, that they were still important to you, that they were still in your heart and still on your mind. So a lot of times when there's alienation, and especially when there's denial of access and those kinds of things, it starts to become a contest of, you know, how can I get to my kid, or how can I force the other parent to let me get to my kid? Don't go there. Just stay in the place where you think in terms of, what does my child need? My child needs to know that this parent still loved him or her, thought about him or her, took time for him or her, considered him or her. And so if you put your heart in that place, it'll become a lot more obvious the kinds of things that you can do. If that means sending a little postcard, or if that means, making more efforts at calling and leaving a voicemail, you never know, one of them might get through. Think about what that kiddo needs. Email. I knew one parent who sent a postcard every single week, and he made a photocopy of it. Every single week he made a photocopy of the postcard before he sent it. His daughter never got a single one of them. Not one postcard did she ever get. Mom intercepted every last one of them. So when that little girl went away to college and she wanted to find out who this man was, and she was all mad at him for abandoning her, he was able to open up this folder of hundreds, literally hundreds, of postcards that he had sent and had photocopies of. And that was the key that helped them reconcile, because that little girl needed to know that her daddy really had been there for her all that time, and that was important. So put it back in the framework of the kid, like we talked about before. What does my kid need? My kid needs to know that I'm there for them, even if the other parent is blocking it.
Yeah, even going as far as, you know, if you know your ex is going to withhold your children, you still go to the meeting place. You still go where you're supposed to be to get your child for your custody time. You know, if they're not there, then you just stop somewhere, purchase something so you have a receipt that shows that you were there at that time. And, you know, it's going to be really painful, but you're going to be able to document not only for your child but also for the court to hopefully help your custody case. And, you know, the same as the postcards. Eventually, if, you know, your child comes to you later and is like, you know, why did you never come to pick me up? You were supposed to come to, you know, our house. And you can say, well, no, I was supposed to be here. I was there. Unfortunately, you know, it didn't work out. Let's try to move, you know, on from that point. But you'll have the proof for whoever you need it for, whether it's your child or the court.
Another great point is to always enjoy the child's company. What I mean is focus on that. Never speak with the child about ongoing litigation. Never speak poorly of the alienating parent to the children or around them. Never, ever show the children any court orders or other sensitive documents. Don't let the children overhear inappropriate conversations on the telephone between you and another person. It's really, really important when you're combating parental alienation to put your best foot forward all the time. I'm going to repeat myself and say it's a lot easier said than it is done, but it's critical. Important for your children as they're being brought up to ultimately recognize who made the effort to be the righteous person, I mean, for lack of a better term, who always encouraged good communication, who always fostered a good relationship with the other parent, and who, you know, it's not going to be obvious, but if you have no history of speaking poorly of the other parent, they really can't. They won't have a recollection of you doing that, and that's going to be important as time goes on.
Yeah, a big thing as the child gets older especially is really appealing to the child's intelligence and getting them to think critically. And this is one you have to kind of be careful with, but it's one that's easier when, as Janie was suggesting, suggesting for some things earlier, is, you know, asking the child questions rather than telling the child, no, that's a lie, no, that's wrong, no, you know, your parent, other parents telling you things that just aren't untrue. Asking them things like when your child's saying, you know, they're scared of your house and that's what they're telling the other parent, you say, well, you know, what have I done that scared you? They're going to think back and, you know, when they can't come up with something, they're going to realize, you know, why did I say that? Why was I feeling like that? You know, it can be difficult because they're kind of brainwashed and they may not get it at first, but if you keep asking those questions, you know, if your child says that, you know, they get sick at your house all the time, you know. I don't remember you being sick recently, you know. When was the last time you were sick, you know? And did I take care of you if they were sick, you know? Did I take you to the doctor like normal? You know, getting them to think along normal lines can be difficult, but asking them questions that they can answer themselves is more productive than just kind of telling them what they should believe, because that's probably what the other parent's doing. So you want them to figure out their own feelings and then own them, that they can't then say, well, you know, dad said that. So that's really dad's feeling. You want them to own the feeling.
Yeah, essentially what you're saying is to investigate the specifics of the negative remarks made by the child about you. I mean, we're going to reiterate that there's a need for caution here. However, when the child does make remarks like, mom or dad was nasty or evil or stupid or abused me, explore the root, the details, and if given the opportunity, discuss the allegations with the child, again in an age-appropriate manner, and see if you can guide them to the truth. And when I say guide them to the truth, you're not alienating, you're not doing brainwashing in your own right. It's as simple as the Q&A, the question and answer session that Lexi just mentioned, where they have a particular belief, you ask the questions that will steer them back to what's real. That, yes, I've been sick, but I've taken care of you. We went to the doctor. We went to the amusement park. We did have a good time on vacation, and the truth will eventually come out. One of the other things I wanted to discuss with you a little bit further, Janie, is when is it okay to help encourage the child to confront the alienator? Now, I know that the way that's worded sounds strong, but it's, again, I understand it's a difficult undertaking depending upon the age of the child, because often the child identifies with the alienator and they live in fear of retribution. They're going to get punished. They're going to have their toys or their games taken away. But depending upon the age of the child and their maturity, and their ability to articulate themselves and still be respectful, are there instances where it's okay to encourage the child to, in a respectful manner, challenge the notions that are being fed them?
That really is a hot potato, because the risk of you putting the child in the middle and between the two is just so huge, because of that, I would say, on those rare occasions when it would be important to do that, oh my goodness, err on the side of caution. It would be better to make the mistake of not confronting than it would be to make the mistake of encouraging a child to confront and have it blow up on you.
Kind of tools or recommendations could you make to an alienated parent that would help put the child? There's so much confusion that goes on in a child's mind when things like these are going on. How can we teach the children to acknowledge the truth and yet still protect themselves?
Okay, so, and you hit the key right there with the last two words, protect themselves. Because before there's a confrontation, what there needs to be is a boundary. And so a child can learn the importance of having a boundary and the importance of maintaining those boundaries. And that can be learned a little at a time. And those are learned in parallel with the same thing we were talking about just a moment ago, with them owning their own perceptions, owning their own experiences, and learning to feel confident in expressing those according to their own autonomous subjective experience. Okay, so that's step one. Is I would never encourage a child ever to confront an alienating parent if they haven't learned, first of all, to very confidently own their own perception. That would be the first thing. The way they can do it is just, first of all, sustaining and maintaining a boundary. Let me give you an example. Little Johnny comes home or goes back to, say, mom's house, and they're in the car, and mom is interrogating little Johnny and saying, well, you know, what did your dad have his girlfriend over this weekend? Was she there? Did she spend the night? Did she go to dinner with you guys? And all that. Okay. When that interrogation happens, as Johnny gets more successful at maintaining his own boundaries, he can say something like, that's a grown-up thing. Or he can say something like, I don't want to talk about that. And that's not necessarily confronting mom right there, but what that is that's just learning how to set and keep his own boundaries. Like, this I don't believe is appropriate. That's grown-up talk. Or even for a child to learn to say, that's not something for me to talk to you about. I hope you'll call dad and ask him. Or, you know, I hope you'll call mom and ask her about that. Or we'll have that conversation and go. But so it's not necessarily a face-on confrontation, but it's a child learning to say, wait a minute, in my experience, I'm not supposed to have to be engaged with this. That's a grown-up thing. So, therefore, I do have enough wherewithal now to say, this is my boundary, mom. I'm not going to answer that question. That's a grown-up thing. And then they'll use kiddo words and not grown-up words like what I'm using right now. But they'll have a way of saying, no, you don't get to intrude in that. You don't get to extract extra information out of me. So there's that. Beyond that, I think the only other encouragement is that I would say encourage your child to own those perceptions. And again, let me go back to my example with one of my clients who's the one who had sent the postcard. At the point where his daughter was ready to come and discover all of those postcards that had been sent to her over the years, at that point in time, she was extremely angry, and she did want to go confront her mother, and basically she wanted to tear her up. At that point in time, I would not have encouraged her to go confront her alienator, because there was too much emotion and there would be too much of a possibility that that emotion would swing too far the other way. And then the girl might become estranged from her mother instead of being estranged from her father. That's not a good outcome either. And so in that case, I would have been actually in a situation where I would have encouraged restraint until her emotions had settled down. And then let her, you know, go and confront mom and say, why did you do this? And, you know, what do you have to say for yourself? And so on and so forth. I guess what I'm saying is that it's okay to let your child know that you support them. It's okay to teach your child to autonomously own their own feelings and their own subjective experiences. It's okay to teach your child boundaries and to teach your child how to express those boundaries so they can maintain them. But I don't know that I would ever teach a child to explicitly go and confront their alienator and demand an explanation. If that child feels like that's necessary, I think I would let them follow their own heart on that.
Very good.
So the next suggestion that we have kind of ties in with the postcard thing, and that's really keeping a digital voice journal or a written journal. And that can include not only the effort that you have taken to, you know, maintain contact with your child if you've been being denied. You know, even if you have contact with your child, keeping a journal is a great idea to document, you know, all the things that you've done, you know, as far as photos and all of that, just so that if there are problems in the future, you know, you have something to come back to. And basically, you just want to try to take every advantage that you have to make your child realize and understand that you love them. So, you know, if you are being alienated or you live far away from your child or, you know, maybe there's a temporary restraining order in place, take advantage of these. Especially now, I mean, with, you know, online journals and all of that, it's not going to cost you anything. You can make sure everything's private. And when your child comes to you and they're ready to take on that relationship on their own when they're older or when you finally get through the court system and they're kind of forced to come to you now, you're prepared to show them that you've thought about them this whole time, you know, and you've been trying to do everything. So that kind of leads us into documenting PAS for custody cases, which Janie's going to talk about. Obviously, this is very important to most people on this call and to us as well when we're helping clients, because not only do you want the time with your child, you want your child to have a good life, and having a parent who is alienating them against the other parent is not fun for them.
Yeah, I think the interesting point in cases like that, and again, there's no difference depending upon the severity. It's not all sunshine and roses at the alienator's house all the time either. There's that undertone of hostility that the children are also living under. So they're being trained to not have a good time at the targeted parent's house, but that doesn't mean that everything's all great at the alienator's house either. So everybody who's listening tonight and who will listen to this teleconference on demand also wants to understand approaches for documentation of parental alienation and how it can be used in court. Ultimately, there's going to be a change or attempted changes in the way things are handled in terms of communication, in terms of the custodial arrangement or parenting time arrangement, and all sorts of other things that can be associated with parental alienation. So, Janie, how do we go about documenting parental alienation for custody cases?
Okay, so, again, I want to put this in terms of a framework, first of all. Okay, so the framework for documentation for parental alienation is, number one, you're not going to be surprised to hear this, focus on the children. And let me explain some very simple verbiage that about how I didn't get my access to my kids, or I can put it in terms of my children did not get their access to me, okay? The second way is the right way. So make sure that in everything that you document it from the point of view of the children and what the children needed, not what you had a right to or what you wanted. Okay, so that's number one. Put the focus and the emphasis on the kiddos. And number two, put the focus on actual behaviors, not subjective judgment, not conclusions, certainly not any mental health diagnoses, but behavior, specific behavior, okay? So if you think in terms of that framework, focus on kids, focus on behavior, and then the last thing I want to talk to you about is the terminology that you use. Understand the legal terminology of your own jurisdiction, the court, if you've got it in your court order, and match your terminology to that. So if they call it, you know, custody, you call it custody. If they call it access, you call it access. If they call it visitation, you call it visitation. I hate that word, but if that's the word that's being used, that's the word you use, okay? So use their terminology. So within that framework, let's talk about how we can speak to the issue of parental alienation without using the actual term PAS, because with all the controversy surrounding it, it actually makes perfect sense to discuss these issues in ways that are clear to the court. Doesn't matter whether there's actually a syndrome. We're not here to argue that. Parental alienation exists.
Yes.
So in order to give yourself the best possibility of reversing parental alienation in the courtroom, up to and including gaining maximum amount of parenting time with the affected children, the following recommendations. Try these. Number one, never violate your court orders, regardless of the situation, unless there's a serious emergency, and then make sure you have third-party verification of that. This means, number one, child support, pay it on time and keep current on it. Also, make sure that all of your current parenting time agreements are followed to the letter if possible, or at least to the spirit of them, because I know some of them have such flexible terms like reasonable that following them to the letter is impossible, so follow the spirit, that being the case. Number two, take a comprehensive parenting course, and I'm not being self-serving when I say this just because I teach them. It looks great on you if you can provide evidence that you have undertaken serious efforts to increase your knowledge, skills, and abilities as a parent. We all can improve as parents, and so be humble enough to go out there and take a class. Make your parenting skills at least
you know, threshold, acceptable, adequate, and if possible, superior to the other parent. Hire an attorney if economically possible, and I will tell you right now, as a coach, I won't coach somebody who's not represented. That's for my own protection, but that's also because I feel so strongly. You're talking about your kids here, and in a legal system that can screw you over, get a good attorney. If you just plain cannot afford to get an attorney, and sometimes it's not economically possible, then do educate yourself and become as knowledgeable as you possibly can. In your case, if there's alienation going on or high conflict going on, make sure you get an attorney who understands high conflict personalities, who understands high conflict divorce and custody situations. Some do, some don't. Some have a really bad attitude about high conflict and then just roll their eyes and you know, and cash your checks. Because personality disorders do drive so much of today's divorce and custody litigation, it's important that you find an attorney who understands those disorders. It's perfectly acceptable to have that be one of your five going-in questions when you meet with a potential attorney. Become knowledgeable about how your family court system works. I absolutely recommend taking a day or two out of your life, and I've heard all the excuses, so don't tell me why you can't do this. Take a day or two out of your life and go sit in the courtroom of the whatever court is going to be hearing your particular case. Start to understand that judge, understand his or her quirks, understand how he or she rules, understand what gets them fired up, what gets them turned off, what gets them aggravated. Learn what you're working with there. And by the way, if you haven't hired an attorney yet by that point in time, I always recommend that you go find your next potential attorney in the courtroom. Watch how those attorneys interface with the judge. Look and see which ones the judge makes eye contact with, the ones that the judge shows respect to, the judge responds to. There's your potential attorney if you haven't hired one yet. Okay, become knowledgeable about the processes. See how the attorneys work. See how the language that gets used. Note what gets objected to. Watch how the judge interacts. Understand your court processes and procedures, when things need to be filed, what the deadlines are, where you go to file things. No problem at all getting to know the folks down in that clerk's office. Many of them are far better friends to you than your own attorney will be. So get to know them. You need to become knowledgeable about your state statutes as they pertain to child custody and child support. You absolutely have an obligation to know the law. It applies to you. It applies to your children. So you need to understand that. Don't just leave that in the hands of your attorney. Make sure you know what your rights are. You know what the law allows and doesn't allow. Of course, this is true if you're forced to represent yourself, but even if you have an attorney, it's best for you to know what the law gives you. Don't ever show up to court without a comprehensive parenting plan. Don't go and say, well, something needs to be different without having a pretty good solid suggestion of just exactly what you think should be different. Make sure that your parenting plan clearly demonstrates how the children will be completely cared for while in your custody.
I wanted to add to that. That's really, really important. In addition to that, it also demonstrates to the court just how serious you are and the level of information, the level of thought that you've given to your custody case. Along with the parenting class that you've suggested here, I recommend to every client. A lot of times I like to say that a good attorney won't just speak with their client about what it is that they hope to get in terms of custody, what they want the outcome to be, but will actually ask the client to, I want you to conceive of a parenting plan, even if it's just a rough draft. I want you to articulate in writing all of the things that you've considered, because then it becomes the framework for which they can develop a more comprehensive plan. But the court custody evaluators, a lot of the people with whom you're going to interact by force or voluntarily, are going to be looking to understand exactly what you want in terms of custody, and coming ahead of time with a parenting plan definitely will demonstrate to those authorities just how much thought you've given this whole process.
Right. And not only that, but remember earlier in our conversation tonight when we were talking about extracurricular activities, for example, and how that is absent and so many court orders are silent on that issue, How many court orders are silent or ambiguous on issues such as phone calling or certain access issues?
Yes.
So, again, if you want those details in your parenting plan, walk in with them in your hand, because a lot of attorneys and judges aren't going to be savvy enough to think, oh, we better talk extracurricular activities. Maybe they're going to assume that's not important to this particular family. But if they're important to your family, add them into your parenting plan. That's the best way to ensure that your parenting plan is going to include the things that are important to you and not end up being silent on those items that you're going to end up battling with the other parent with over later on.
Great.
Keep a diary or a journal that keeps a record of key situations. I cannot emphasize this enough. Every day. Don't let the day end without sitting down and writing. Here's what you want. You want to talk about the time that you spent with your kiddo. You want to talk about specific activities that you're involved with. If those activities involve any kind of third-party corroboration, did you take them to scouts? Note the scoutmaster's name. Did you take them to soccer? Note the coach's name. Did you go to a parent-teacher conference? Note the teacher's name. These are all third-party evidence that can come in and help corroborate that you're an involved parent. Did you take them to the doctor? Keep the receipt for the copay. You know, all of those items, but every single day, sit down and think to yourself, what did I do that engaged with my child today? Okay? The other thing that you will always document in your journal is, when did I attempt to have conversation or access with my child today, and it was denied? And you can write that down. Tried calling at 6:30 this evening. There was no answer. Left a voicemail. Or, you know, but always document those particular items. And I mean every day. Don't let the day go by without writing that down. Milestones, events, anything you are a part of for your child, record it, document it. Dates, times, details, every single bit of that, put it down. Nothing is be sure that you remain stable. And, oh, my gosh, I understand completely, I do, how hard it is when you're a target. You're always on the defensive. The attacks seem to come relentlessly. You are always walking on eggshells. You see evidence of the damage happening to your children, and that bugs you. This is stressful.
I also want to add, for remaining stable, we recommend this a lot. I think you would, too. Seeing a therapist or a counselor to manage those emotions is really, really important, and can go a long way to help keeping you from, you know, popping off when you least expect it.
Yes, absolutely. Also, to that point, again, I don't mean to be self-serving here, but I do want to put one plug in for coaching, and that is, coaching is not therapy. It is not mental health. Sometimes if you go see a counselor, the other party might try to hold that against you or try to make a play like that makes you, you know, an unstable person. But if you're seeing a coach to help you manage your emotions, nobody can hold that against you. So I would not stop going to see a counselor if that's all you have available to you and you need that help to manage your emotions. Please don't try to do it by yourself, because this is stressful. So I absolutely second what Michael said about getting some help and having somebody kind of guide you through this. But I would give preference to seeing a coach versus seeing a counselor, only because a coach can't be held against you. A counselor might be. Maybe not, but it might be. The main thing of it is do not give the court or the alienating parent any reason to portray you as unstable. Keep in mind that this is the person you were married to. They do know how to poke your buttons better than anybody else, and they will. So understand that right when you're feeling the most stressed, the least resourced, and the least stable, is about the same time that they're going to find that one red-hot button that you've got and poke it real hard. So be sure that you have a means of managing those emotions before you go into a situation. And finally, don't get caught up in how terrible this all is. I know I just got done talking to you about how terrible it all is. But
ironic.
but you know, there's a lot of good here, because these are your kids, you know, your kid or kids, and there's a lot going on. So don't give up on them. Don't ever give up on them. Stay with it always. If what you're trying isn't working, try something new, but keep on keeping on in it. And and find the positive. And let me put one more thing out there, and this is just going to sound really awful to you. I know you're going to hate this. Find something positive about the other parent as well. If you don't, you risk getting caught up in a splitting situation. They split on one side. You grab the other end of the tug-of-war rope and start splitting on the other side. That doesn't work. So as much as this is difficult to do, think of one positive thing that you can say about the other parent. If nothing else, that'll go a long way if you get stuck in custody evaluation situation, because all custody evaluators are trained to watch for splitting. So if you can't think of one good thing to say about that alienating parent, work on that until you can, so that you don't end up being one of the a splitter person. But bottom line, don't give up on your kiddos. No matter how hard it is, don't give up. Keep trying.
Yeah, we've actually seen that in court, a judge asking both parents, you know, what positives do they have to say about the other parent, and the alienator parent could not say anything positive. So they do ask that question. It's hard sometimes to come up with something, but there is something, even if it's something small. But come up with that list.
To your point about not getting caught up in how terrible it all is, this entire teleconference is about discussing things that are very, very stressful, that are horrible, that are depressing, that are life-affecting, that really have tremendous impact on the children. But don't forget, the goal of the teleconference is to try to get people centered on what's important and to be able to handle these situations where, without the experience of people like Lexi or like myself or your experience, Janie, and the experiences of all those people with whom we interact, we can't come up with these tools and discuss these strategies that are going to turn things around for people. So the fact that we're having this teleconference at all, and that we have people who are listening and who are getting tuned in to what they need to do to help the children navigate through this as well as get through it themselves, is very much a positive.
Okay, we are going to turn now to a question that we've been sent on the call. I'm actually going to start with the emails that I am just getting in now, so I'm going to throw Michael and Janie off.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, so here we go. First question, if the child is still in toddler ages, can parental alienation still be considered a concern, and how do we address this in court?
Oh, I need a second to think about it. So at toddler age, we're talking 2, 3, 4.
4 and under, I would say, yeah.
My opinion would be, and Janie, you can speak to this as well, is that it's probably less of a concern. You know, at those ages, the children tend to mimic anything that's going on. And, you know, not to be flip about the response here, but, you know, they might go from imitating a bird one day to imitating mom and then imitating dad. So they have a tendency to grow out of these things. I guess the concern that you have is that as it progresses into, or if it should progress into the years just beyond toddler and even longer, then it's a matter of all the documentation and coming up. We speak a lot on the site, in our articles about compiling objective evidence. When you're getting into the ages of 5 and 6 and 7, well, then the things that the children are going to remember and not just be parroting, because that just happens to be what they tend to do at the toddler age, become more of a long-term concern, and then it might be something that you need to broach in court.
Yeah, and I think part of, and we have questions from people that kind of pertain to this too, is, you know, what does the court actually care about? You know, there's certain alienation behaviors that, you know, they see as very minor, or it may not even really be affecting the child in a way that the court deems important. You know, if your child's not having behavioral issues because of these things, or, you know, they still want to come see you even though they're being alienated, you know, they may not see it as important. you certainly do, and I think, you know, this is obviously a huge issue that's still going on in court. You know, they recognize physical abuse right away. They don't necessarily recognize emotional abuse and what that means to the child, you know, on in through adult years, and they really don't do a great job addressing that. It's changing a little bit, but some of it, honestly, they're just not concerned about it.
Well, and I think in a lot of courts, in fact, it's going to seem as though the court is in collusion with the alienator, especially if the alienator is mom, because there is an awful lot of the old tender years doctrine that is left over, that bias definitely exists. The idea that a little kiddo needs mom way more than dad, and will miss mom way more if they're not around. And so this might actually be one of those situations where you win by giving ground. And by that, what I mean is, if it's dad who is the target here and you've got a little kiddo, 2, 3, 4 years old, rather than having dad coming in with guns ablaze and saying, you know, here's all these behaviors and, you know, denial of access and so on and so forth, but instead be willing to acknowledge that there is this leftover tender years doctrine that kind of still smells around the courthouse, and then say, okay, well, let's start prepping this kid to have more of a relationship with dad later on. Right now, dad can have, let's say, maybe 3 short visits a week, rather than dad trying to get kiddo for the whole entire weekend, which is just going to be a mess right now and a huge battle. So what I'm saying is win by conceding some ground for right now. Kiddo is 3 or 4 years old, and dad says, you know, rather than trying to make this kid adjust to being at my house all weekend long and that's hard on them, how about I come have dinner with the kiddo on Sunday night, Wednesday night, and Friday night, or whatever it is. What happens there is dad still has enough contact with the kiddo that they can still establish the relationship. But what he's not doing is he's not setting the court up where they're going, oh, my goodness, you know, kiddo is going to miss the mommy because it's so long and it's overnight and so on and so forth. And I would be inclined to try to strategize like that over the long term, because that will help combat that parental alienation while the kiddo is little. It establishes that contact. And then, you know, the dad can put in, and they can put into the order, this will get revisited on the docket when kiddo turns 6, so when kiddo starts school, or whenever there's a different age milestone, to come back and say, okay, we will now look at upgrading and changing this. But if the goal is to combat alienation, additional contact is one of the best things that you can have. And it might be that additional contact in this particular case with little kiddo looks like more frequent for shorter periods of time. And it looks like a concession. Sometimes that's even easier to get past the alienating parent because they think they've won. But what the end result is that targeted parent has more frequent opportunities to combat what the kiddo is being said by the alienator.
Great. Our next question is, I have a very high conflict ex with no physical custody. In severe, intense, and systematic parental alienation when on the phone with my son. He's very disturbed, and our relationship is in a shambles. What is a good strategy for letting my child speak to this parent in a healthy manner, staying on kids' subjects, and preserving my relationship with him? And unfortunately, we don't have an age for this child.
Does DPDX have no physical custody?
Correct. So it's just
phone
conversation. Got to keep them healthy.
All right. Well, I'm going to go. I'm going to presume that the child is older than toddler stage or 5. Let's operate on that presumption. One of the things that it can be very helpful, you know, you have a divorce coach here and a custody coach here, and one of the things you talk about is coaching, but coaching in a healthy way. I think a lot of times that if you can, and it's different, it's difficult, it's always going to be difficult for a child to manage a discussion with an adult under any circumstances, but when they're particularly, in this case with a BPD, our writer indicates, to be almost impossible. But preparing them ahead of time, if there's a set time where these phone discussions take place, sit down and go over some fun and interesting and upbeat topics that the child might be inclined to discuss with them. So get them ready for the conversation so they're not just winging it. And again, depending upon the age, you might have some tools that you can deploy with them where they can teach them how to redirect the conversation back to subjects that are of interest to the child, even when the alienating parent or the high conflict, or in this case, the parent is trying to get some other topic of discussion going that isn't appropriate for one reason or another, and maybe give him the tools to redirect the conversation back to topics that he's interested in discussing. Because, again, it's about focusing on the child. It's about the child's needs.
Any input there?
Don't have anything to add to that. Just remember in all situations that you focus on the child and think about what that child needs. It sounds like Michael really covered it all.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I really think a person who submitted this question really is thinking about the child. I mean, I think it was a great question, and it is kind of one of those basic things that you have to teach your children how to speak on the phone, and teaching a child how to redirect an adult is a concept that unfortunately a lot of us have had to deal with, and you just really have to think about it and, you know, put it into practice. So another question that was submitted is how to deal with younger kids who feel like they can't be away from the alienating parent, and it's usually in a situation where the alienating parent is saying, oh, I miss you so much when you're gone, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do because you won't be here, and, you know, how do you get them to feel safe and comfortable and, you know, not thinking about the alienating parent, you know, when they have to be away from them and they're spending custody time with you, Janie?
Well, again, what you've got here is just the stark evidence of an emotional enmeshment where the alienating parent, it's not just about alienating, it's about them feeding their own emotional needs, using their children to do so. And I think the number one thing that you can do with your kiddos, first of all, understand that even when they say those things, even when they express that, that's still just fleeting. For a kid, they can so quickly be distracted to other activities, other toys, other things that are happening in the other parent's home. So it might not even be worth more than just a mere acknowledgement, or acknowledgement and then confidence, you know, to say. It's too bad. It's like maybe it's dad who's saying, you know, oh, I miss you so much. You know, maybe it's okay for the other parent to say, you know, I understand that dad will miss you. I miss you when you're not with me, too. However, I'm a grown-up, and I handle my emotions, and dad's a grown-up, and he can handle his emotions. Let's go do, you know, fill in the blank and move on. So acknowledge that the kiddo is being, you know, enmeshed, but then give confidence that, you know, that parent can handle their emotions. They're a grown-up. I do it. They can do it. And then leave it at that.
You can also, give them examples. Hey, you know, before you were born, mom or dad was able to live in an apartment by themselves, buy a house, get a car. They really can survive without you.
Yep.
Just a short period of time. You'll be back to them soon enough, but nothing bad is going to happen just because you're away from them for the weekend or for the week or even for the summer, depending upon what your custodial arrangement is.
Right. So acknowledge, reassure, move on.
Okay, so this is a great question, actually. Is parental alienation done because of insecurity, control issues, or what do we think is going on? I don't know.
Yes.
It's a great question. I think most people have it, you know. They kind of want to fix the other person still, I think, and if you know why,
yeah,
maybe I can, you know, step in there.
So that the answer is E, all of the above, on any given day or time, and D, it doesn't matter. We're still going to focus on the kiddos and the kiddos' experience and what the kiddo needs. We just don't need to squander any emotional energy whatsoever on trying to diagnose or figure out the alienator. You want to. I'm sure there's books out there that do. But really, truly, your kid needs you to be there to help them manage this situation. What they really don't need is for you to try to figure out why they can't do what they're doing. I don't mean to be callous or to take it lightly. I promise I don't. But I've seen all of the above, and I've seen them all come out of the exact same person. You know, one day it's because they're insecure. Another day it's because they want control. They need their children to feed their own emotional stuff because they don't have other emotional supply, and so they're using their child as their emotional supply. Tons of reasons for it. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter why the alienator is doing it, and that's just not going to be what's going to fix it.
Yeah, you understand that it's I was going to concur entirely with you. It's one or more at any given time. It could be insecurity. It could be control. It could be emotional enmeshment. It could also be I just hate the other parent. It could be punishment for things that they believe were done to them by the targeted parent. But at the end of the day, the goal is to help you get your children to manage it, to navigate their way through the situation, and get through it as healthy individuals and ultimately healthy grown-ups, as well as to help you get through it as well.
Yeah, this is also a great question, and fortunately I think I know the answer. Is the family court system going to take the necessary steps to punish the offender? Probably.
Probably concur with that as well. I think, you know, and I understand people's disdain for certain aspects of the family court system. I have my own issues with the way the family court system operates and how they conduct themselves. But one of the things that you have to understand when it comes to family court, aside from the fact that there are so many families involved in it across the country and, quite frankly, across the world, is that when you're it's easy to present facts and evidence, and where things get dicey is when you're presenting that, you know, there's a question about he said, she said, and conjecture, and this is what's happening. Family courts, they process so many cases per day, so many cases per week and year, that they only get a snapshot, a very small snapshot of what you're experiencing, and then it's really based upon how much testimony that you give, how much objective evidence that they're going to see and then even consider. So we as victims of the parental alienator want the court to see the whole picture. And the unfortunate reality is the courts will never be enough time in a day, in the week, in the year, in a lifetime for you to convey to the courts the depth of the problem that's going on in your family and in your life. So to expect that the court's going to punish the offender when so much of what we experience with regard to parental alienation is words, body language, little tactics. Like, you know, let's use the pet example since we talked about that quite example. How are you going to go in and convey to the court that this was a tool used to undermine your custodial time without looking like a wacko? I mean, the reality is you've lived it. You know the experience. You've had the experience. But the court will never be able to comprehend that in the confines of your specific situation. So to expect that they're going to punish the offender for what you're going through when they're literally incapable of understanding the scope of the problem in your case is a long shot.
Well, things to keep in mind too regarding, you know, thinking in terms of punishment, and thinking in terms of the law. The law doesn't have a remedy that doesn't basically harm kids as well. I mean, even no matter which parent it is, you find them money, that's money the kids don't get. You put the parent in jail, then kids, you know, have a parent in jail. You know, whatever it is you do to the parent as punishment, it impacts kids, and courts take that into account. sometimes. Now, again, I'm not going to go over into the child support realms because I have my opinions there. If you want to know what they are, you know, go on the forum and read them. They're very strong, but that's not what this is about. But what I do want to say is that there actually are situations where parental alienation does get, for lack of a better word, punished. And what that is in some courts where judges do acknowledge that this exists, and some of those are right here in Texas up in the DFW Metroplex because of the influence of two of the major authors regarding parental alienation, because both of them are right out of Dallas. So there is some influence there. But my point is, in those cases, the conventional wisdom remedy for parental alienation is to remove the child from the alienator altogether and give them to the targeted parent with absolutely no contact with the alienator. Gives the targeted parent the opportunity to right the situation and allow the child to be exposed to the real parent instead of the fiction that the alienator has created. This sounds like a great idea, and when you read about it in books like Divorce Poison, for example, and Richard Gardner's book, you think, well, yeah, that's right. You know, get the kids in and give them a chance to see what the truth is. In reality, I've watched this happen on three different cases of mine so far, where literally at court, the child or children, in one of the cases, were remanded over to the targeted parent. It has been a disaster all three times. Because even if the targeted parent was prepared to receive their children, you know, as far as like their home and beds and so forth, which in two of the cases they didn't. But even in the case where they did, the children were so emotionally unprepared to go, and there was no recourse laid in place to help enable the children on that path. All the kids knew was that they could not see the parents that, in most cases, they identified with and associated with. Excuse me. Very strongly. Oh, dear, I ran out of water.
Well, I can take over. I was going to say that from some of the situations that I have seen or read about, particularly there were a couple cases in Canada recently, those that have gotten some high-profile attention. The problem is that in the cases that I am familiar with, that the parental alienation was so pervasive and so long-term, I think in one of the cases it was more than a decade, that so much damage typically has to be done, and it has to be abundantly obvious to the court, to the judge who's presiding over the case, for such a drastic measure to take place, that it's almost not a remedy at all, because the children are damaged. Relationship with the targeted parent is oftentimes damaged beyond repair, even as, like you said in the examples that you had mentioned in your area, that the ultimate outcome doesn't end up getting to be positive.
Yeah, and I think that's hopefully one of the good things that will come out if the APA approves parental alienation syndrome as a mental disorder. Then something will be put in place that, okay, this disorder is real, first of all, relationship. Here's how it has to be treated. Right now, the court system doesn't have any clue how to treat parental alienation. Really, no one does. And so they're stuck. They have the choice to either leave the kids in that situation, or what they think is the better option is take them completely out of that situation, and neither one works. Or the children, or really anyone else in the situation. So hopefully that will be changing.
Well, and just to finish my thought, I do want you to know that ultimately in all three of those cases, they did finally resolve to a good outcome. But in the immediate term, it was a mess for the kiddos. And the outcome could have gone a completely different way. In all three of those cases, it was pretty hairy for a while. So just to say, yes, some courts do acknowledge PAS. Like we said before, don't focus on trying to use the word or convince a judge that that's what's going on. Just emphasize the kiddos, emphasize actual behavior, through third-party objective evidence and let the court conclude for themselves whether or not alienation is taking place. And if they do, like I said, they really are left without any decent remedies in the law right now. There just really aren't any.
So another question that came in from email is a little involved, so try to follow along. Have a husband who is alienating the child. He moves in with his girlfriend and their young daughter. The daughter is 8 years old, and they have convinced the daughter that her mother, her real mother, is dead and that his girlfriend is now her new mother. Of course, the problem is mom is not dead, and they're just beginning the whole custody thing, so the court has just started visitation for mom, but he's trying to keep her away from the visitation time so the child isn't seeing mom. So she wants to know how can she stay in her life and convince the child that she's not dead. I mean, gotta try. The first thing that comes to mind, whether it's calls, cards, I mean, anything, has to get in contact with her.
Well, she says they're just starting visitation.
But he's not. Really.
Oh. I would have to believe that a good attorney would petition the court for immediate relief on a child. I'd like to believe that emergency petition for interim custody order would be offering, and if there's custodial interference, that some action would be taken in that regard.
Well, that's really kind of an unusual and an extreme case, and not that it's you know, any less important than any of the other more run-of-the-mill situations, but Michael, I think you hit it right on the head. That parent needs to get legal assistance and get in and get an emergency order, even if it's something as simple as let me see the kid for an afternoon, because, I mean, all it's going to take is just a moment and then the jig is up, right?
Yeah,
it seems like kind of a silly thing to try to convince your child of. I mean,
you can't imagine.
You know?
I mean, what's to stop mom from just showing up at the house and going, hi there, I'm not a ghost?
Yeah. I mean, you have to laugh about some of the things because you just go, you know how easy it is to prove that what you're saying is a lie without even telling the kid that you're a liar.
Right.
Want to laugh, but it's not funny. I mean, it's
not.
Oh, goodness. Okay, moving on to our next question. Children are resilient. We all know this. So how much does parental alienation affect the children throughout their lifetime, and are they in danger of becoming alienators themselves as adults?
I don't know. I don't know that there's any way to directly tie the experience that they're going through as children into. Projecting out that far, you would have to surmise that there's a strong possibility that they would enter in a relationship, get married, have children, and then actively become an alienator. I would say that. I would presume that there's certainly a possibility. I mean, it depends on whether or not they've been able to overcome what they experienced. I mean, we do tend to act on that which we've been taught as children, so certainly I would imagine that the possibility exists. But really it depends on how they transitioned, how they managed to get through that particular time in their life, assuming that they ever did, and how they grew into adulthood. And how they're going to interact with the marital relationship and children, and if that should not work out, how they would manage their own custodial situation.
I want to make mention of Amy J.L. Baker,
She has done an awful lot of studies on parental alienation syndrome. And, oh, by the way, she has also done research on the intergenerational aspect of it, and they have concluded that it is indeed intergenerational. If a child has grown up in an alienated household, they are a lot more likely to either be an alienator themselves or to end up in a marital situation where they're divorced and they become alienated. So they become a target. So, yes, it's a huge, huge effect, intergenerational effect. But the book, Adult Children of Parental Alienation Syndrome, Breaking the Ties That Bind, actually talks very specifically about the effect of PAS on children throughout their lifetimes. The research that Dr. Baker did looks at adults that were alienated as children and goes into how they interact as adults as a result of the PAS. It's a heartbreaking book, but it's very eye-opening.
Yeah, and it really makes sense to me. I mean, I would automatically say they're going to be more prone to being alienated themselves because that's the relationship dynamic that they've seen. If they haven't seen anything else, that's normal to them, one, and number two, it's the only way that they know how to interact. So even if they didn't recognize that, you know, they were hurt in the situation, they don't necessarily have the tools at their disposal to do something different. You know, they're going to fall back into what their parents did to them, just like, you know, any other situation, whether it's, you know, a relationship with your first boyfriend or, you know, your friends, you model those relationships on the relationships you've grown up with. It's just natural and, you know, so that's not really shocking. It's sad, you know, obviously we don't want that for our children, so being able to combat it as early as possible is obviously important for their quality of life, you know, throughout not only the childhood but going into adulthood as well, so. So, which brings us to the other question that everyone always asks, which is, do children of parental alienation come around as adults and reconcile with the other parent, or is the damage permanent?
It goes either way. I've seen it go both ways. I mean, that's the simple answer. There are those who grow up with the, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, that sinking feeling that something isn't quite right with the world, and maybe they seek answers and they come to understand that they were mistreated and alienated against the particular parent, and they seek to resolve the feelings that they had as youngsters. And there are those who, unfortunately, never have that opportunity. They either are so alienated from their targeted parent that they just have no desire, where circumstances change and they just never get the opportunity, even if they did find out differently.
Yes, and I don't think the relationship is ever the same, even when they do reconcile with targeted parents. There's just so much missing. Going back to another individual that I know well, he's not a client of mine, but in his particular situation, he refers to it as his relationship was cut off at the knees. He says, you know, I can still, our relationship still has wheels and can get around, but it'll never walk. And that's kind of how he likens it.
Okay, so kind of a good question, actually. I think everyone kind of goes through this at the beginning, especially with phone conversations, is how do you handle communication with the alienating parent when the kids are with you? So the kids want to talk to the alienating parent. You know they're going to do something on the phone to encourage poor behavior or, you know, more specific alienating behaviors, trying to start things on there. So do you allow the calls? Do you monitor it? Do you script it? How do you handle it?
That's teaching tools. Again, you know, at the risk of repeating ourselves again, I mean, there's different approaches depending upon the age of the children or the child involved. But again, I spoke earlier of preparing for phone conversations. Let's, you know, what kind of things would you like to share? What was your favorite thing to do this week? What was your least favorite thing to do this week? Give them topics that might be of interest to them. You know, give them a little bit of a primer about the kind of things that happened, and get them focused on discussing things that they want to share about their life with the alienating parent. And again, depending upon the age, tools to redirect the conversation back to the child's activities when the alienating parent's trying to get them to go elsewhere.
Okay, and we're going to go on to our final question of the evening. And I think this is great, because when you're in a high conflict, fussy situation, this is what happens, and it basically never ends. So how do you deal with a moving target who changes their tactics when confronted with facts?
Janie can start with this one.
I need water. No, I already got the water. The main thing there is that you're the stable one. And so if you always work within that framework we talked about earlier, putting the kids first, making sure your energy goes toward them, seeking stability from the other authority figures in your life, the court, the judge, et cetera, if you provide that foundation, then even if the target's moving all over the place, you're not aiming at that target. That's not your goal. So they're going to try all these different things, but that's not your target. Your target is your kid. And your target is making sure that your kid comes in knowing that they're loved, they're cared for, that they're stable, that they can trust you, that you're committed. That's your target. And if you keep your focus centered on that bullseye, the alienating parent can dance around the edges and change tactics all day long. Doesn't matter. Your response is going to come back to that same framework.
Great answer, Janie, because that's where I was going. Focusing on the children, a lot of the questions that we get, we've gotten for this particular program have a common theme where they're trying, the person who's asking the question is looking for how to manage the alienator rather than how to manage the impact that the alienator has. So as simplistic as it might sound, the goal is focus on the child. Focus on putting up these barriers that will prevent the impact, the ultimate impact that the alienator is trying to have on the child. And if you do that, if you can insulate them and give them the tools and give them the opportunities and show them the right way to handle any given situation that involves the alienator in an age-appropriate way, that's where you're going to get maximum impact, the biggest bang for your buck, or whatever cliche that you want to throw out there. The focus in parental alienation situations is controlling the things that you can control. You're not going to control the behavior of the alienating parent. You do have greater control over the impact that those behaviors can have on the child.
Exactly.
All right. Any closing thoughts, Lexi?
No, I think we covered it. I think we had some great questions, and hopefully we helped a few people.
Janie?
Stay with it, stay strong, stay in it for your kids.
All right, folks. Thanks, Lexi. Thank you very much, Janie, for joining me tonight and for giving such great advice to the listeners.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thanks to everyone who submitted questions as well. You will be able to download this parental alienation teleconference recording in the member area of the website within about 48 hours so that you can listen as many times as needed. We hope that you found the teleconference to be interesting, informative, and for those of you who are dealing with parental alienation on any level, we hope that you found it helpful. Thank you very much.